Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 17, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern until midnight. If you were listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250. Access code 449-389-pound. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. That's plural, questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right side of our website and donate $5 a month or more. Tonight's scripture reading is going to be in chapter 6. We're going to pick up where we left off, just starting in chapter 6 now. So, Gospel of John, chapter 6. We'll read, it looks like it's going to be verses 1 through 21. All right, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them that were diseased. And Jesus went up onto a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. When Jesus then lifted up his eyes, he saw the great company come unto him. He saith unto Philip, When shall we buy bread that they may eat? And this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 pennyworth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, saith unto him, There is a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but that what are they among so many? And Jesus said, Make the men sit down. Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in numbers about 5,000. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to his disciples, and the disciples to them that were sat down, and likewise the fish as many as they would. When they were filled, he said unto his disciples, Gather up the fragments that remaineth, that nothing be lost. Therefore they gathered them together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which remained over and above unto them that had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, This is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into the mountain himself alone. And when evening was now come, his disciples came down onto the sea and entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not come onto them. And the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing nigh unto the ship. And they were afraid. But he saith unto them, It is I, be not afraid. Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately the ship was on the other, was at the land whither they went. Okay, that was the Gospel of John, chapter 6, verses 1 through 21. You know, we're still working on the lawsuit for suing the judiciary, of course, we're going to be suing the American Bar Association and a few others. The Senate Judiciary Committee, the Congressional Judiciary Committee, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the National. Well, we're not going to sue the National Lawyers Guild, but we will do, of course, sue the American Bar Association. Anyway, we are working on that. It's actually grown to be quite large paper, and I'm trying to break things up maybe into memorandums to make it a little bit easier read. But anyway, we're working on it, and we hope to have it done as soon as we can and get it filed into the courts. We also have our campaign for sheriffs, campaign for constitutional sheriffs. Anybody who can donate, we're looking for donations, of course, as much as people can afford, a one-time donation for this project where we plan on sending a sheriff's handbook to every sheriff in America. There are 3,134 or 36 counties, and so there's probably about a little over 3,000 sheriffs. Some counties don't have sheriffs, but anyway, about 3,000 sheriffs, and we're looking to send 20 books to each sheriff so that they could pass them on to their deputies. They'd be, you know, pocket handbooks. Anybody who hasn't read that book, you can find a copy up on nationallibertyalliance.org, and just click on the PDF copy of the Sheriff's Handbook. We're going to be updating that Sheriff's Handbook before we actually pass it on for printing. But in any event, we've got some things to add. Since we've been writing this paper here recently, we've come up to some new things that we want to really add into this book. And also we want to talk about in the booklet what statutes are lawful. We spoke about this a couple of weeks ago. We might have spoke about it a little bit last week, that there are, I believe it's 52 titles, USC, U.S. Code titles, numbered 1 through 52, or maybe it was 54. I think it was 54. And of the 54 titles, only 27 of them have been enacted by Congress. So the other ones really are not law. Amongst them is U.S. Title 26. Also, we discussed over the past couple of weeks the fact that U.S. 18 is the law of the sea and not the law of the land. If people want to talk about that, maybe they might want to ask some questions on that, and we can talk a little bit about that when we go into the open forum. But we did talk about that over the past couple of weeks. I just wanted to bring it up. You know, it's important that we understand, you know, what statutes are law, what statutes are, well, actually, they're, you know, what statutes are not law. And there are a lot of statutes that are lawful. Again, there are many jurisdictions, particularly on the federal level. U.S. 18 is where you find the penal code. And again, that is the law of the sea and not the law of the land. Let's see. I don't know, Jan, do we have any announcements? Jan, I saw you here a short while ago. Oh, you're muted. Let me unmute you.
I have one question. I do not have any announcements for this evening.
Okay. All right, well, we'll take the one question anyway.
Okay. Let me dig it up here. It's short and sweet. Who can I contact in regards to inquiring about and obtaining land patents in the state of Pennsylvania? I have noticed from listening in for a while that a few of the callers that phone in on Monday or Thursday night seem to hold land patents or allodial titles to their property. Any comments and info would be appreciated.
Yeah, well, we haven't really, I don't think we have spoken about it on a Monday night program, so maybe on another evening program they've spoken a little bit about it. The allodial titles, I think that's how they pronounce them, allodial, is that how they pronounce them? Is that the titles?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, it's not something that's going to be simple to do and to move forward. You know, if you really want to try to remove your land from or your house from taxes, you're going to really want to try to make an argument with the town and have it categorized as private. I think it has to be categorized as private. I don't recall what that was. It's been a while since I've thought about this. I know it's Gerard here because he may know a little bit more about this than I do, and I don't see him here. Private property, that's what you have to do. You have to put categorized as private property. And once that happens, then they have to remove it from the tax scrolls. That's going to be an uphill battle. And I don't particularly know of anybody that actually has accomplished that. I've heard of some that have done the allodial titles, but again, I don't know what the success of that is. You know, we're working, of course, on the lawsuit against the judiciary for the sole purpose of bringing back courts of justice back in the federal districts, you know, on the federal level. And then at that point, then we will be able to deal with all of the state courts and bring them back into courts of justice, or being able to open up courts of record. And then at that point, we can deal with the unconstitutional taxes upon property. Obviously, if you have to pay a tax on a property, and if you don't pay that tax, they take it away from you, then obviously you don't own it. And so it's a slave tax, just like an income tax. And we definitely have to do something with that. And I think between the reset that's going to be coming up at some point in the near future with what Trump is doing and the work that we're doing, hopefully in the courts, between the two, we'll be able to solve those particular problems. You know, we'll see how things go, but again, I don't know that you'll have much success, on the allodials. I know a lot of people out there claiming success. I don't know if anybody within our group has had success. Maybe they might want to talk about it if they have. But a lot of people claim a lot of things out there, and are not necessarily true. I know we've learned a lot off of the internet, and especially in the very beginning, about the problems and you know, the unlawful statutes and so on. But again, a lot of it is filled with a lot of falsities. So we have to be very careful on what we want to use and work with and spend our time with. All right. Anyway, is that the only question? I think I lost.
That was the only question. I think Crystal had some comments she'd like to make.
Okay, Crystal, go right ahead. And if anybody wants to get into the queue, star six to get into the queue. Crystal, maybe you can get into the queue. Hit star six. Oh, you're already unmuted. Go ahead, Crystal.
Yeah. Hello.
Yep. Go right ahead.
How are you doing? Yeah, I tried
Good,
to call
yourself?
You last week. Oh, okay, hanging in there. I
Good.
Sent you that
Good.
Paperwork and everything, and I did a cover sheet.
Yes, I do have that.
Okay, well, guess what happened last week? What I did was I sent, there was four sheets, the two pages that they had to fill out, the amended sheet, and the fax cover sheet. And I sent it to the chief attorney, chief judge, chief clerk, even to the mayor's office. They had to refill these things out because everybody in position, there's always a chief attorney and a chief clerk, you know. And at the end of it, comma, E-T space A-L. So that covers all the attorneys that are working for the courts, the city, whomever. And back in August, because I did it with the appellate court, and they, when they had me into the courtroom, they said that they are, they had me as a, a serial bankruptcy fraud, and they wanted everything to stop. They wanted me to stop all emotions, and they wanted to move forward. And so the retired judge had ruled against me and went over the appellate court and said, foreclosure, we deny you. They can start the foreclosure. And my next date was supposed to be August 17th. So what I did in turn, I sent those letters, and I addressed it to, I even sent it to the Senator Blumenthal and all them. Did you see that segment on TV with all of us on the TV station? And then they put it on YouTube? About
no,
the veterans. As a matter of fact, well, me and the group of people down here, we were all on TV with Richard Blumenthal, Senator Richard Blumenthal.
Mm.
So he goes, oh, we're going to stop the foreclosures for the veterans. So now we've been getting a lot of the veterans calls because he did announce there on TV. And so, and I've been representing myself since, you know, for the past over 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that last case back in August, they had the two attorneys and the GE Federal Credit Union, which surprised me, to me when I went into the court, I'm like, and the judge, they were all ruled against me. And they had me in there at a certain time in a different courtroom, which, thank God, I brought the people. I said, look, I just want some court observers in there. And when they did my case, I was not prepared for what they were going to throw at me. But I thank Jehovah God that I remembered all my dates and everything, and they were really shocked. I said, first of all, I gave you the subrogation. You never responded. You showed me no proof of claim, no contract. Who is the injured party here? What investment did you invest in my property? I said, on November 7th, your law firm went and put their names on my property, and then a week later, you put GE Federal Credit Union, like I just purchased the property. I said, you have committed RICO. This is perpetrating a fraud. I asked you for the proof of the proof and the original contract where I signed. I said, as a matter of fact, you used the Federal Reserve with my Social Security number, and this has been 7 times. I said, you all reaped a lot of money off of myself and whomever else that you've been changing. This mortgage is called a MERS. I said, who changed my name and who signed my name? And then I also told him about the Amendment Act of 1938, and I said, can you please, and I sent all that to them. Well, the next week, and then I put motion to order a motion, and I did another appeal. They said they was not going to accept it. So what I did, I left the clerk's office, and I went and I faxed it to them. Well, they stamped it. Then they turned around and sent it back to me. Oh, well, guess what? You got it. Okay? So then I sent them that the papers I sent over to you.
Mm-hmm.
And now the judge, that retired judge, he did not show up for court that day. Okay? And so they sent me another foreclosure again to move forward for a date. So when I went into the court, now they had a female attorney, a female judge, and she was going to be taking over the cases. So again, I sent a third letter to them. Well, so when I went back to court, it was the 27th of August. That Monday, that attorney She went running in there, and she had motion ready, you know, to move forward with the foreclosure. And I had my paperwork together. She jumped up and told the judge, motion marked not ready. I then stood up. I said, motion is ready and is marked ready. I said, and by the way, Your Honor, she sent me the letter stating that the motion's ready and I am here. And so she goes, Your Honor, motion not marked ready. We want to stop this. Now, everybody's looking in the courtroom, okay? So I said, but I would like to speak. He goes, well, there's no need for you to speak because she stopped it. So now he sends me a letter in the mail vacating premises off. Okay. So now they thought they were slick, and they send me to another law firm, and this is where they got caught in their lies. They said, oh, good, we're going to get her now because we got her on delinquent taxes. Well, you're always paying a year behind, so all my taxes is current. So they came up to the wrong person on that. So I said, well, that's great. So I went and got all my receipts, and then I sent that new group of attorneys, I sent them that little nice love package. All righty. Last week, they did not show up. So they had all these papers lined up for me on the court agenda. So I had court again today. So when I was in court last Thursday, the judge said, this is the new judge I got now. This is the third judge in the past 3 weeks. We could hear your case. So when I went into the courtroom, when they called my name, I said, I am the authorized representative of Crystal, and my last name, comma, and also the agent. She goes, and I said it again. And so, you know, she was cordial, I was cordial, and again, when I went into court again, I said that again. And so she says, well, you are the representative agent of, you know, she said my name and last name. And she goes, well, look. She goes, well, you didn't mark it ready. I said, well, Your Honor, it wasn't for me to mark ready. It was the attorneys, the three attorneys, this new set of attorneys that sent me the letter, and they were supposed to mark it ready. She goes, but they're not here, and you didn't mark it ready. I said, Your Honor, again, it was not my motion to mark ready. It was the other attorneys that put me on the, on the schedule, and they were supposed to mark ready. Okay, so I said, since they are not here, I would like this case to be totally discharged and dismissed. Then she goes, well, since they're not here, we can't move forward with it. I said, well, I would like for you to just totally discharge this case and dismiss. I've been harassed for the past over 4 years. As a matter of fact, it started with Becker and Zowine, and here's one of their attorneys right over here. She put her face down, but she wasn't there for me, and her face turned as red as a beet. So then she turned, she goes, look, I'm tired. I don't want you to see you keep coming back and forth. She goes, you know, they're not here. Last week they didn't show up. I said, yes, Your Honor, and I would like for you to totally discharge this case. She goes, I cannot discharge this case because I have no jurisdiction over you. I said, but last week you said that the judge, retired Judge Jennings, recused himself from my case. And then this group of attorneys, they took themselves off my case. So why am I here and being constantly harassed? Can somebody please discharge me from this case? She goes, look, I'm sorry that they keep on calling you back, but I have no jurisdiction. See, none of them filled out that paper, John. Okay? So now they're all backpedaling. And when I presented the case today, She goes, I see you did your homework and you used the law library and you know it very well. Well, all the attorneys, because her being new in the court, they called me in the beginning and the court was packed. So all the other attorneys put their face down and I said, in no due process. And I said, I've been harassed. I said, nobody. I said, I've been coming to this courtroom for the past 4 years. I said, first of all, any case over $20, I could have a common law grand jury, which you denied me of my constitutional rights. Secondly, any case that is put together, you have a year and a half. And if the case, if either side cannot prove the case has to be dismissed. This has been 4 years. I said, thirdly, I said, I did the subrogation and no one ever answered. So it should have been dismissed back then. They never showed proof of claim. I sent the declaration. I also have the warranty, grantee, life use of my property. Who is going to sit there and sign and change my legal documents? I said, and when these attorneys falsified and put their names on my property, who authorized and who signed their name? And see what I did, I put my affidavits when they did it right in the beginning. I went right behind them and put sworn affidavits on my deed. So guess what? That's why I was able to sit there, you know. And it's a process we've been learning, but some of the stuff I was somewhat familiar with. And I learned a lot, you know, from NLA. So this is where we stand right now. So when I got home this evening, I received a letter from the courthouse again. And it was from the judge I had today. She wrote, motion, vacate off. I said, isn't that wonderful? So this is where we stand right now. So I'm going to file another affidavit tomorrow to see if I can have this whole case totally discharged.
Can I say something, Crystal?
What does that mean, vacate off?
That they can't move me out of my house.
Motion to vacate is off. In other words, the judge squashed a motion to vacate from the other side.
Yeah, see, none of them want to touch the case now. And now, because Jennings, the one who's caused all this, who we got the case against, mm-hmm. he recused. 2 o'clock Thursday afternoon, the clerk came upstairs, and I saw him whispering. I said, I know it's about me. She goes, well, you know what? I don't know what you're even here for at this point, because Judge Jennings recused himself from your case. I said, well, the attorneys took themselves off my case the week before. Well, he recused himself now.
Look, when those attorneys had you show up, and they didn't show up, and the judge said she had no jurisdiction over you.
Yes, that was today.
At that point, you should have said, let the record show, and you should have dismissed it yourself. The judge has no jurisdiction. The other side is not here. I dismiss this case. I'm making a ruling right here in this court because they called you in. You showed up. They're not there.
Yes.
By default, I dismissed the case. That's all you missed. That's what you should have done because that judge is telling you she has no jurisdiction. This is an administrative court. And let me tell you something. They operate under crazy statutes, and they don't recognize the Constitution or anything like that. They're using UCC, but they twist things the way they want them. They're not using a loyal title anymore because they don't recognize the signing it with the Secretary of State. I mean, that's the legal way that's supposed to be done when you own property. But what they do now is they put it under the Emergency Powers Act that was signed in 1933. So they basically say that you don't have any right to private property. That's what they believe. And there's paperwork that shows that in the UCC. That's something that maybe we should expose in the courts because it's totally unconstitutional.
And that's what I got.
I can't believe that they're operating under it, but they do. But when there's nobody there, they call you in and they don't show up, you should say, look it. let the record show that the other side has defaulted, not shown up, and I dismiss this case, and dismiss it yourself, just like Thornton does, because now you're the top person in the court. The judge even told you, I have no jurisdiction over you.
She said it three times, and that's so, everybody.
So who was the top guy in the court? The attorneys weren't there. It was you. All you had to do was proclaim it. It's like Dorothy, click your heels together.
Well, you know what? She told me, it was packed too, and those other attorneys, which I've known a lot of them in the past, they said, you put one hell of a case together. They said, you need to come work for us. And she said, I see you know your law library very well. She goes, and I'm sorry
you,
they keep
Crystal.
On question. Huh?
They're afraid of you. They're afraid that you're going to get them doing something that they're going to get caught on. And right now, Trump says he's going to restore the rule of law, and they're not under that rule of law. They're operating under a fictitious system, and that's what needs to break down. And that, in order to get back to the law, they have to get all that baloney out of there.
All right, so wait a minute. Let me just go over one thing. Okay, so because they got me back. I got another court paper. They got me on the docket for the 24th again. So I'm going to sit there and send all that in. So when I go to court next week, and I know they're not going to show up, okay, now say that I'm – say that again, what I should say?
Well, you say, Your Honor, let the record show that the other side is not here. That's a default. I'm here. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to move ahead. And
that would be the third time in a row.
Right. And you say, and I've been informed that this judge, this court has no jurisdiction over me. So based on those facts, let the record show that I'm dismissing the case and being the only operating principle here, that the subject of the case is me. They've defaulted, and I'm ready to go. So I'd like to enter the ruling on my behalf that I dismiss this case. You have a perfect right to do that. This is a hearing to determine how you come out. And if they're not there, then you get to proclaim it. It's your court then. The judge is telling you she has no jurisdiction, so she can shut up.
Yeah, she kept on saying it.
Right, and so she doesn't want any part of it. She doesn't want any part of it because she knows that they're doing fraud. That's why.
Okay, and see, the other judge, he came in after Jennings, and he wrote, vacate off. He wrote, and he didn't even show up. He goes, you ain't got to say nothing. This vacates off. Nobody wants to take over his case.
Right, because they know that they got a problem. They never answered you to begin with. They never gave you any proof of claim. They never showed you the contract. So, look, that's all contract law that they violated. Now, they don't believe in the Constitution, but they certainly know contract law, and that's where you have them.
And I'll tell you, if you have to go again and you find yourself being brought back again, I think it's time to move it to federal court for cause. Here they're violating your right of due process.
But see, the federal court was fine. As a matter of fact, this is what I did too. The letters that the ones I sent you,
mm-hmm.
I sent it to the Superior Court, the Federal Court, and the Appellate Court. And I sent it to all the chief. And somebody said, why did you send it to the chief? I said, because you know what? Every time when I would go to court, I said, well, who's your supervisor? So there has to be somebody in charge over somebody. And that's when I learned there was a chief judge, a chief attorney, a chief clerk, and then you write ETAL, so that's covering them all.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wow, I remember.
Well, didn't you try to send us into federal court?
Yeah, they kicked her back.
Yes.
But
federal court that wrote me up saying that I was a serial bankruptcy fraud.
The federal court did that?
The federal court, yes.
Wow.
And then they told me, this is where they try to block me with the appellate. Oh, this is what came out, too. I forgot to tell you 3 weeks ago. They said, according to the appellate, because the appellate court and the federal court all ruled against me, and last week of August 25th, because it was that Friday, they sent me the letter, and I couldn't rebuttal on it because the courts were closed. And on Saturday, the 25th, I received a letter from the appellate court stating that they ruled against me and that the foreclosure is a go-ahead.
Which appellate court?
The appellate court in Connecticut.
Okay, but it's not the federal court.
No, it's the
appellate. That's where your next step could be, is into the, you know, you got to move it up the line for violation of your right of due process. And my thinking here is that if you've already moved it into federal court for cause, and if you didn't have properly, and then they have made a decision by calling you a serial what?
They called me a serial bankruptcy fraud because I filed four times. But I said that's not true because I had death in my family, and you knew that. I said
It's all the same bankruptcy. You're not in there four times with a bankruptcy.
Exactly. It's the same case,
and they're not fixing it, and they're calling it serial because they got itty-bitty minds. I think they need a letter from the grand jury ordering that judge to straighten out the lower courts to do his job.
Maybe we could do something like that.
Moving
it over into the federal court, maybe we'll have to look into see. Maybe Brent can help us on this. Instead of appealing it, really you want to move it up to the appellate court or to the higher court for the sole purpose of correcting the lower court. I'm not sure how you would do that in a federal court if that would be going up to the appeals court. Now, if it's going up to the appeals court, the question becomes, you see, they love to charge you a lot of money. I can't believe they charge you $500 or $550. I forget which one it is, just for the appeal on a federal level. I just can't believe that they're doing that. Of course, you know, in one of the cases that I pushed through that way, we're going to be asking for money back on both cases, you know, as far as the $400, $410. And then it was 500 and something, or 550 or 500 to go into the appellate. Brent, do you know if there is a way you can move for a motion for the higher court to make a ruling so the court case could move on without having to pay that 500 and some odd dollars?
It depends upon, I lost the call. I think I know where you're at in this conversation. It depends upon whether there, my memory serves me correct, there are about three ways you can appeal before the case is concluded. As the general rule is, you can't appeal until the trial court has run its course, whatever that course ends up being. But there are some exceptions. Of course, if you've got a question that you're appealing that would end the case, and again, I'm speaking from memory, I tried this a couple of times, in federal court, if you've got a motion on the table that would end the case and the court refuses to hear it, then if I remember right, you can appeal that up. But it's really easy to find out. You just go with the internet, we can find these things out quick. Just type in some buzzwords, and it'll tell you what the three reasons are under the federal rules of civil procedure that you can appeal the case before the end of the case below.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'll look into that because I'm studying right now the federal rules, and so far the only real problem I'm finding with the federal rules is Rule 12. There's really nothing wrong with Rule 12. If we had honest, just judges that would really apply it correctly, then that would be fine too. But it's such an abused rule. And even if you follow Rule 8, and Rule 8 lays out what is the process, or what is the required need to make up the case in a federal court. And if you follow the ABC rule there, you know, you have to cover this, this, and this. You know, if you follow those rules and you cover those 3 points, I think it's 3 points or maybe it's 4 points, but if you cover those points, then how can they throw you out for failing to, I forget what they call it, failing to make a claim of something? Do you recall what that's called on Rule 12, Gerard? Failure to make a valid claim or something like that.
Right.
But if you're following Rule 8, which gives you the, you know, the process, you know, the ABC, the necessary points, you know, how could they throw it out? And even with that, they still throw it out. But I've also noticed the only time they apply Rule 12, the only time it's ever used that I've ever seen it used, and the only time it's ever, and it's always, you know, whoever applies it always wins against the individual, because it's always the pro se. It's always applied against the pro se individual coming into the court, and they always get thrown out. So this way they don't have to answer these questions. I know I just recently was thrown out on a case, and I shelled up the $500 or $550 to move into the Court of Appeals, which I think I'll get a good decision from them. And as a matter of fact, our New York case is sitting there under Rule 12 again, they were supposed to make a decision back in June 19th. And here we are coming into, September 19th. And they still haven't made a move. And, you know, I'm thinking of writing a letter to the judge to find out what gives, what goes on. You know, what's going on here? This isn't a big deal. You know, if you're going to throw it out, throw it out. Well, let's move on.
Well,
you know?
This is what's been happening down here in our courts since we've been filing the letters. And a few other people, so I said, well, let's just see how it goes from here. I don't know what the outcome. But anyways, all their cases, the ones that followed suit, three of us had ours today, all of them, they didn't want to deal with any of our cases. Now, another thing, too, I forgot to mention to you. These courts down here, today there was like 80-something cases, and most of the cases were, they said, they took them off. They even took me off the calendar for today. Okay? Mm-hmm. We got all new judges. Everybody, this whole courtroom is scrambled like scrambled eggs. Okay? People are retiring left and right. Now three new clerks, a new chief clerk. Then they brought the old one back, and then he left. Then the other one. So it's just like, and I said, who signed this paper? So when I went down, I said, I got this. Who signed this paper? Who's in charge of this? So when, and I said, who's the chief judge? Who's the chief clerk? Who's, you know, so. And I said, ask whoever's in charge. Get their name. Make sure you put a name on it. And you address it to them. And then you write the ETAL. Because they are the chief.
You know what you are, Crystal?
What?
You're our mind canary on the Donald Trump deep state shakeup. That's what's going on. These people are leaving because they got stuff on them, and he's already told them. They know they got to go. So
a lot of people have left, and now it's just like we got some of these other crazy, incompetent ones. It seemed like they sent the worst ones over, and it's just so crazy.
Well, they're probably running out of people to replace them with. You know what I mean?
And nobody knows their job, so.
And they're all afraid to make a move because they know that the cat's back home. You know what I mean?
Well, see, they brought us all together. So, like, now, I mean, I've been getting calls from all over the state. People are calling me from all over, you know. And I'm like,
I hope you're CCing the sessions in them on everything.
I'm sorry.
Let them see that you're CCing Jeff Sessions.
Oh, I told them, everybody, you know, I said, contact your state rep, your congressman, all of them, you know, and a lot of people saw us on TV, and stuff. And I said, now, you know, just like the big meeting in the Common Council tonight, it was all about the foreclosures, but of course they didn't let me speak. And everyone, you know, when I was trying to work with different ones, they get a piece of the pie and they want to take over. And I said, good night. I'm not going to sit there and argue. You do whatever you want to do. You know, I mean, I've been, you know, following through. And so they said, well, I said, go on your website, and they have a conference call of National Liberty Alliance. Start learning it. You know, if you think I'm going to sit here and spend my days and nights, I said, I've given 4 or 5 years of my life. I said, guess what? Enough is enough. You know? So, I mean, we're learning together. And,
well, did we do a paper notifying them that nonjudicial foreclosure was a crime?
Oh, yeah, a long time ago, John.
Yeah, but I don't know.
I don't know.
Maybe,
did we do it?
I'm pretty
sure.
There
was something.
I think Jim would know because he was handling your paperwork.
Yeah, but go ahead, Crystal. Do you have any memory of this?
Yeah, there was something that you filed in the court, federal court. Because that's when Jennings
passed. Well, filing it into the federal court was just, then we must have done a nonjudicial notification to them, nonjudicial foreclosure notification in order to file it into the federal court. But we'll look back to see if we did or didn't. Maybe we should do that.
Yeah, as I said,
maybe we can be a little more creative on something new now. You know, we've got more knowledge since we've written that paper up, and maybe we can add to it and do something a little more to it.
Before I forget, there's one other thing I forgot to tell you. That executive order of December 21st that Trump put into place, and I guess it came into law, was it July? No, I'm sorry.
No, January 1st. January 1st is when it was really going to take effect.
Did he sign? He signed off on it. I think was it June 12th or June 18th. It's a law.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, because one of the other ladies in the court, because she's like, she goes, Crystal, remember you gave us that executive? She goes, well, this is when it was June 12th, because he's June 12th and June 18th. But I put that on there, and I also amended that front cover, the executive order, the criminal, all that, along with those pages, you know. And as I said, it was just like, I guess it's all been helpful.
Well, you know, in the filing of the into the federal court, and I guess you had filed 4 different papers. Were you filing different papers because you were trying to figure the proper way to do it, to get it into the court, and so you did it a few different times? Is that what took place, or what exactly took place with that?
Yeah, see, what happened, that, what is it, that amendment of that 1938, they were blank forms. And then we put a cover sheet together, okay? And on the top I wrote, the first sheet is the amendment sheet we put together, and the second sheet is the line to who it's going to. So what I did, I would maybe like five names, and then for the courts, I send a certified. I said the chief clerk, the chief attorney, and the chief judge. So they were all going to the same place.
But for the federal court are sticklers for form. And, I mean, they're really, really are sticklers. But you know what? If you're coming in as pro se, they're supposed to give you that extra hand. And besides that, their boss has already ruled that the only thing necessary for a prima facie case is a sworn affidavit, period. So, you know, that's something that you can bring to the attention of the judge if necessary. But if you really should go read the federal rules, and particularly in the back, you know, when you get towards the end of the federal rules, you'll see there's a lot of forms. And they tell you exactly how to lay this out. And as a matter of fact, if you go look at our papers and our filing papers on the New York case, for instance, for the gun case here in New York, which was a federally filed case. If you go look at our case, you can see the format that they like to see, okay? And I'm pretty sure we've got something up there that shows you how to move into the federal court for cause. But if not, you know, we'll try to find something for you. The big problem right now is, you know, I'm personally way too busy until at least next week sometime. I got some things that I got to get done. It's the timing or the
okay,
or I default.
And that's no problem.
But that's what we need to do, I think. And maybe you know, maybe you need to, maybe we can work out something where you petition the grand jury for assistance with the problem, and then maybe we can try to do something and file something on your behalf as an assistant and let the judge know that he should have been doing this, that he should have seen that there was some injustice going on here. Maybe we can chastise him a little bit and push some paperwork
well,
in.
Well, see, he's gone. He's a retired.
No, I'm talking about the federal judge.
Right. But what about the prosecutor in her area? Trump has put a lot of new prosecutors in. And have you checked
your docket to
make sure that's all going? I would send him a nice little letter. I wouldn't send him a whole bunch of legal stuff because they won't want to read it. But send him a letter and just summarize what's going on in those courts and say, look, this is RICO. This is fraud. I've been in here for 4 years. They're calling me a serial whatever. And I believe that you need to look into this.
Yeah,
you know,
but that's
because
the federal judge that called her that, right?
They were all working together.
Is that the federal judge? Are you sure
the federal judge
called
said
you
that.
The serial? Now, did
that came from the federal.
In the court,
his name
did
is
he send
Shay.
A paper? Did he send a
yeah,
paper?
Yeah, but see, they're all,
but did
yeah,
he do,
it's in
but
the
he,
paper.
But did he do this in writing?
Yes,
okay,
it
he
is.
He called you that
yeah.
in writing. And
yes,
you've got copies of the four papers that you filed over time. And, you know, maybe muster that together, and next week sometime when I can get the time, maybe I'll take a look at that. You
okay,
know, we should
I'll
try to meet. I know it's real difficult to get me, as I know you know. But
yeah,
I
sent you something.
But we
did
do
you
need
get
to try to do something. Yeah, I did. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah,
but we do need to
could,
do something, you know, to pull
if
these
she gets
papers
all
together.
That together and we look at what the judge said in that, we'll know what to do. But I'm thinking maybe that's what we base our letter on, our from the grand jury.
Yeah, we do want to see the papers, yeah. Because then,
right, you,
you
need
know,
to
we,
see
we
them. And then we can send it to the court. We can also send it to the prosecutor saying, look, you got a problem. You need to go clean house over here.
Okay.
Yeah, well,
we'll
send a copy to Jeff Sessions also, because we send a copy to him and also the president on everything we do anyway. So, and we send it to the Senator Grassley on the Judiciary Committee on the Senate level. We probably should be doing this on the congressional level too. But,
and then I had another incident with the Social Security for my husband, you know, the widows, and they turned around. I said, well, so where does all this money go? Who's getting the money? They said, well, it goes into a kiddie fund. I said, oh, really? I said, well, I don't recall. Why would my pension and my husband's Social Security, who never, he never lived to see a day, and it was, you know, I had it mine for him, he had it for me. I said, so why do, who gets the, they couldn't answer. And I said, by the way, I came down here five different times. And I
so
got
what,
five
what kind of a fund, where does it? Where do they say the money goes?
It goes to some kind of, goes to a general fund. I said, well, guess
general
what?
Dodge.
I said,
you should call it a slush fund and see what they say.
Look at that paperwork with the UCC stuff in it that says that we don't own property. It says that all this money is put into a fund, and because they took our rights away, they had a remedy.
Yeah,
for
but
us.
That's in their own minds. That didn't really
there's
happen.
Something that
it's
they've been
law,
doing.
John,
real...
it's on the Federal Register. It's law.
Yeah,
even
yeah
though
but
it's
it doesn't mean anything. It's null and void because it's repugnant.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
the whole process and all the
and even Trump said about
point.
That.
And you also have the other side of the coin. I mean, you build the case coming up right back from Marbury versus Madison right on up. You could
but
build
I
an
would,
opposition case.
I would
case
use
and,
their statutes against them. I would use that UCC code and say, if you think that you can take my birth certificate and my Social Security funds and put it in this fund, and then they're telling you they're going to pay your electric bill and all this crap, but they never told you how to do it. Right, that's your remedy. They're supposed to play any public debts, and they never
do. Yeah, but that's getting.
So wait a minute. So you're saying, the UCC, I need to put that in there, the UCC form?
No, what I'm saying is
no.
they they have these rules that they are living by. That's why they feel comfortable not giving you the Constitution.
Yeah, but I think we have to stay above that. We can't get lost in that stuff. We really, really can't, because once we start playing there, it's a tit for tat thing. And remember, it's members club. It's all only their people can do those processes.
But. My pension from them, it was to start. I got the original letter, and my pension was to start December 15, 2015. We're going on 3 years. They owe me over $50,000.
They're admitting in court that they're using this particular rule to steal her money. And at that point, you should say, yeah, I know what that is. That's UCC,
Are they actually doing that? They're actually using those rules, the UCC, what are they bringing up?
Because they just stole my husband's pension and my husband's Social Security.
We know what they've done.
I get nothing.
That's called RICO.
They talk
But what have they done on the, in a paper trail permitted them to do this using the UCC. We really want to see.
That's normal.
Because that cannot be
operandi for them.
Yeah, but but the commercial code cannot be used against the people. Number one, and it depends on what we're talking. We're talking on a federal level at this point, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well. Okay, so we need to know, we need to see what exactly they're talking about. First of all, and again, I just went through this, all 27, there are 27, United States codes, titles, that are lawful as far as that have been enacted, okay? Now, that doesn't mean the other ones can't be used, because they can use them sort of as policies and procedures, because really they're applying a lot of these other things, I think anyway, and I'm still researching this, but, they're applying it towards a lot of governmental agencies and individuals working for them and so on and so forth. But there's only 27 enacted codes. But none of those codes can be used against the people. Look at the federal court, and U.S. 18, okay, is not the law of the land. It's the law of the sea. It's the only place you'll find jurisdiction, and that's what it tells you. It's maritime law. And so that doesn't apply, and that's where the penal code is found. And that can't be applied towards we the people. First off, statutes can't be applied towards we the people. Anytime we go into a court for any purpose, especially if they're coming against us for something, then it has to be in a common law court. It has to be, if it's something criminal, there's got to be a jury. If the government is coming out after you somehow, how does that work out? You can look at U.S. 26 and see the game that they play there. But again, that's not law either. That is the biggest con part, because Section 1, I think it's called. I think it's called Section 1, where they enacted, U.S. 26, and the same day. I believe it's true when I'm saying the same day. Okay, they then omitted it. Okay, they deleted it. So they enacted it so they can call upon it, and then they deleted it, they omitted it, but then they really didn't place it anywhere inside the code other than on the title sheet, which breaks everything down and gives the table of contents. It says it's omitted, and it gives you the date, when it was done. So when you put all this together, the whole thing is nothing but fraud, and that's right. What needs to be exposed, okay? That we are writing up, okay, for the lawsuit against the judiciary is going to do exactly that, lay out the fraud that they are using in order to come out after the people. Now, really, the only cases, the federal government really has no authority or power to come out after we the people in any way, shape, or form. Again, they do it in under USC 18, which again is law, it's maritime law, that's the jurisdiction. of that U.S. 18. I was so surprised to find that out. I don't understand why lawyers don't know this. But, of course, they don't really use their own minds or their brains usually. They just follow the process, what they've been taught in school, and they make a presumption on the jurisdiction. I guess they're told that this is the jurisdiction, and they believe it. So they apply that jurisdiction. But, you see, the federal government really, the federal courts really have no power or authority over the people. Really, the only involvement that we would get involved in their courts ultimately is when we move a case into their district, into their jurisdiction for cause, because they have the final word and the authority over the Constitution, the interpretation of the Constitution. Any case that is a constitutional case, they're the ones that are to be the decision makers. That, of course, we see in Article 3 of the Constitution. So, again, when you move a case into that court for cause, and especially in your situation, in your case, where you've put it two or three or four times, trying to get the paperwork right, that judge should have seen your struggle with that and should have assisted you with that. He had a duty to do that. Now, you can't hold your hand and take your case on, but he certainly can accept your paperwork the way it is so that they can look at the case.
Okay, maybe you misunderstood me or something.
They're never
going to help second.
Her because it reveals the fraud, John. That
well, that's right. I know
they're
not going to
Crystal,
help.
Because they'll heart attack him before he gets home.
Okay,
right, well,
this
Crystal. We do know that they're not going to help you. Okay, that's a fact. At least not right. That judge. Okay, but remember this also. You go in there and talk in UCC. That judge is not going to assist you either, okay? And again, you know, you never know where they're going to come down on you at that point because, you know, look at that one guy that used the UCC out in Connecticut, and then he got a check from these people. As soon as he cashed the check, they waited 30 days after the check was cashed,
it's
and then they raided his house. Yeah.
They're using the UCC.
I did not use the UCC. But can I say something?
No, they are using the UCC against you. I'm telling you, those codes and statutes are law. They're on the Federal Register. And I'm not saying to use it. I'm saying to reveal it. You're going to say, if you think you're going to rest in UCC, that doesn't apply to me. You have to call their fraud out. And if you don't know what to call it, you can't go in there describing a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and not saying peanut butter or jelly. You're going to have a hard time. They just told you. It goes into a kitty. That whole thing I sent out this week, he talks about the kitty that they put the money into and how Congress unconstitutionally elevated the president to extraordinary powers. Congress is the only one that makes law. It's not the judiciary, and it's not the executive. So Congress is all out of whack here with this thing, and they raised the president up to do their dirty work. And let me tell you something. Donald Trump is using their dirty laws against them right now. He has no right to make law on something. He's used their state of emergency that was the excuse in the beginning for taking away our rights because we were in a state of emergency. The Constitution has no provision for suspending itself in any kind of emergency.
Yeah, but do remember, you know, in the case with Donald Trump and what he's doing, and he's got a lot more power than I realized. Okay, more and more I look into the Constitution and trying to really see how all of these title procedures, policies and procedures go, and the people that he appoints and all of that stuff. The more and more you look into that, you discover he's got a lot of powers. And remember, he can change policies. He can't change enactments. If Congress didn't enact something, and there is something there that they're using, because there's, again, remember, you got 54 titles, okay, and only 27 of them have been enacted. Now, I'm going through each one of those individually, trying to see and understand exactly where the authority came from for Congress to be able to write those titles to begin with. And then it's a huge, huge project to try to figure out if all these titles are really even, if there's a lot of repugnant things in there. And I really wouldn't know anything about that because, some of these titles are like 1,200 to 1,500 pages, okay? And it's like looking into U.S. 26. But that doesn't mean that they're unlawful or wrong, because the country has to move, and it has to move according to, you know, law. And that's how things work, according to law. But of the other titles, other titles other than the 27, okay, those titles, even though they haven't been enacted, they can be used, or they seem to be being used, as policies and procedures. Again, not enacted law.
And regulations.
Being used. That is a better word to use, regulations.
They made Title 26, and they realized that it didn't apply to U.S. citizens. And they said, okay, make a regulation. So the regulation says it applies to all citizens and blah, blah. Well, guess what? Regulations don't apply to us.
Right.
But they made it look like
that's
that.
That's a much better word to use, regulations, okay?
Because these titles
that have not been acted are used as regulations.
They have ruled against them four times. And when people took it to court and they said, look, I'm not under that regulation, the Supreme Court said, you're absolutely right. Who is it that's enforcing this cannot expand the statute by adding a regulation and expanding.
Well, yeah, none of them can be applied against the people. It's for government.
Well, what they did is they took the law, the statute, and they drew up a regulation that gave it more power, extended it, because they interpreted it that this is what Congress wanted to do. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not up to you to interpret that Congress wanted to do
this.
If it's not in there, then you can't do it.
Okay, but remember, I think I'm correct in what I'm saying here now, and that is a statute is only a statute when Congress has enacted it. So a statute becomes law. It's law created by human beings. Okay, and it's lawful law created by a human being, because we the people gave them the authority under Article 1, Section 8 and beyond. Okay, even there's other places outside of Section 8 that we have given them power or authority to write law, and that's where all these titles come to be, and that's why it's so important to really understand, you know, which titles are enacted, and the ones that aren't enacted, then they're being used as regulations. Where and how are they being used as regulations? And then that's okay. You look at, they have every right to try to control whatever, you know, agency and all of the individuals involved in a particular agency or grouping, you know, they've got to control them. They control them. You know, when I was in business doing large projects, policies and procedures were required. Otherwise, you have chaos. So all of that is lawful, but it doesn't apply to us. It doesn't apply to you. It doesn't apply to me. That's the thing that we do know and we realize.
It has a very narrow line of what it applies to, and it's not us. We don't live in the district.
Right, exactly.
We don't make tobacco and alcohol. You know, they made it constitutional, but then they misapply it. And look, the president is equal. There's three equal, co-equal branches. Where the president has his power is, number one, he can veto. He can kill law. And, you know, what's this business? They put it on the Federal Register, and if he doesn't sign it for 45 days, it automatically becomes law. That's another
right.
way they
Well, again, that's if he vetoes, but he could change regulations.
No, I'm saying if he doesn't rule on it, it automatically becomes law. If he lets it sit for 45 days, it automatically becomes law. If he
right, but remember, regulations are not law. Regulations, if you have, again, you've got U.S. titles, U.S.C. titles.
No,
okay?
I'm talking about when they make a statute, a legal statute.
Right, but what I'm trying to say is this. United States codes, okay, which are titles, Title 1 through 54, okay?
Right.
Of those 54, and again, I'm repeating myself, but maybe I need to, 27 of them have been enacted, okay?
Right.
As a matter of fact, 28 of them has been enacted, and then one has been retracted and omitted, okay? And that's U.S. 26, and that's their game, you know, that they play with U.S. 26. That's a specialty there because, you know, that's where the the Federal Reserve has its arm, and they can do whatever they please, so it seems. I mean, they're above the law, that's clear. Whatever they do, nobody can stop them or say anything about it. But in any event, okay, these other codes, okay, are still called codes and titles, and the way it's worded, and it's written by Congress, okay, and the way that it's worded, where it gives them the authority to, in other words, use that title and quote that title. I forget the verbiage they use for that. But they have the right to use that title as a title, but it hasn't been enacted. So therefore, it becomes basically like a policy and procedure as you said, a regulation.
Right.
A regulation. It's not positive. Well, you see, even that's kind of odd to see, positive law and non-positive law. Even that is kind of confusing because you have some places that is called positive law, and yet it hasn't been enacted.
Right.
And if
right.
it's not enacted by Congress, it's not a statute. And if it's not a statute, it's not law. And
so
again,
they did
statute,
it purposely. They did it to confuse
us. Well, again, I'm trying to figure all this out, and I'm working through that right now because I think it's important to understand that in order to make our case in the court and acknowledge the fact that we're not saying that that they don't have the power or the authority to write law. By all means, they have the power and the authority to write law. And there's lots of law that is lawful. But you can't make a law concerning us. We're under the laws of nature and of nature's God. That's the law that we, the people, are under. Okay, they're under the law of we the people.
Well, they
they're
got corporate
also.
Fictions on top of corporate fictions, and look at when
but
you go when you follow it through of how yeah, well that look at that doesn't apply to us, but they're applying it to us.
Yeah,
know?
When you reveal the fraud for what it is, and you lay it out and you show it,
well,
that's what we need to do.
Right.
That's what we need to do.
When you look at the IRS and you look at the Bar Association, guess what? The IRS owns the Bar Association corporately, who is owned by another corporation called the Corporation. It's really scary what these guys have done.
Well, I've never looked at that part of the structure there that way, but we know that Bar Association of the Minions developed the Minions of the New World Order, which serve and of course. They serve ultimately the banksters.
IRS, where's their corporation in Puerto Rico? And look who owns them. If they're owned by the Bar Association. And who owns the Bar Association?
Yeah, but it's
this
also
corporation
in the Philippines.
Called the Corporation.
It's also in the Philippines. And when you go against the IRS, you have to make sure if you're going to go up against them that you put both little IRS and cap IRS because they've incorporated under two different ways
They got these corporate papers sprinkled through every state, John. They incorporate in Virginia and Pennsylvania and all over the freaking place.
Right, but we don't have to worry about any of that because, again, that's all just constructive fraud. It's not constructive law, and that's the key, to work with constructive law to expose the constructed fraud because that's what they've done. They put this together in a constructive way to make it look like law and to build upon it, but it's all fraud, and it feeds into RICO. Which is exactly where we start the conversation.
I'm just surprised that Donald Trump isn't in a state of shock from what he's learned from when he was elected till now. Because I'm sure he had no idea how deep this thing went, like he does now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't know. You know, I think he's a lot more he was a lot more educated going into the office, I think, than we realize. You know?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. He's been studying it for years, planning on it. And look, they didn't want him to run until this system was ready to crash. They know it crashes. This fiat money system crashes every 40 to 50 years, and they have a war. They have another state of emergency. They redo the money. They take us off the silver standard. The next one is going to be encrypted currency. That's where they want us, and that's kind of what he stopped now because he they can't have a war now, and they don't have anything to blame the crash on.
Yeah, but that encrypted currency is not lawful money here in the United States, as you know, and we can't really lift it up in any way. Maybe it's something that will help people to have a soft landing with some kind of thing.
It's
that
actually
has a value
no different than the dollars we're using now.
But even that is really built upon nothing.
It's fiat money. It's fiat currency. It's the ultimate fiat is what it is. And the only reason they allowed Bitcoin to go is because they wanted us to get used to the idea that you could do this currency and have digits of money online. See, they don't want paper. They don't want any physical anything. They want to be able to manipulate everything, you know, fictionally. And also they can make it go poof fictionally, too. So that's where they were heading. And that whole thing was crime, too.
So.
Yeah.
I think we need to move on over to Brent, and then we'll open up for a conversation some more after that. Let me just see. I see New York Michael was up there early. Did he have something he wanted to bring up before we move on? Let me unmute Michael first. Did you have something you wanted to bring up before we moved
John,
on?
I just wanted to mention with Crystal, when she was in court, she should have had an order already prepared and just had the judge sign it.
I was going to say that.
Good idea.
She should have had it there, and she should have said, well, I have the order for you to sign it, Judge.
Do that for next time, Crystal. I go to court next week.
Keep it with you.
That's a great idea.
And we'll talk next week, and you can bring up where we may
Okay, but what the only thing I wanted to share with you, what I did, okay, with those letters, I sent it to the Attorney General. I sent it to the
Which Attorney General?
George Jetson, the Attorney General of the State of Connecticut.
I sent
it to all the congressmen. I sent it to all the courts. I sent it to the mayor's office. I sent it to the town's office. I sent it to the bar association.
Did you write down on the bottom of your paper that you copied all these individuals?
Well, you know what? I wrote CC20, and I did this so they don't even know who everybody I sent it to. And
right,
I
but next time, take the time to list all those individuals out.
And make sure you
so
send
that
it
they
to
know
Chastity.
that their crime is being, you know, broadcasted and filed in many places throughout the state.
Right. Okay. And yeah.
That, you know what, John? That alone is enough to unnerve them.
That's right.
Nobody.
Well,
does.
And that's what I did. Because I said, number one, it's CC, and each one, you know, because some weeks I send in, like, 5, another week I send in 8, 10, 20, you know.
You know
so,
you
I
know
mean, there's been all 30 I sent it off.
You're Alfred and, Hitchcock, because what you do is you suggest the terror, and you let them imagine it, which is almost worse than putting who you sent it to. Because they're imagining where it's going, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because they don't know, but they're all getting it.
Michael, I'm going to put you back on mute. You're still in line if you want to talk some more. I'm talking to Michael, though, on that. And, yeah, we're going to do the same thing to you, Crystal. Right. And if you want to talk some more, you can get into the queue. There's only a few people in the queue. And anybody else who wants to get into the queue, start.
Well, no, I'm just saying that, but I just wanted to definitely talk to you because I got to go to court to be observed tomorrow morning, and I got to pick up some people. But I just
we'll talk again next Monday, and we'll see where we're at with potentially being able to
help. Yeah,
because
I go to court next week, as a matter of fact.
Make sure you have an order that you carry with you every time, Crystal.
Now, what is the order? Except you can just briefly.
In other words, you draw the order out for the judge to sign dismissing the case. Like when she said, I don't have jurisdiction and they're not here, you said, good.
Motion of order.
I have an order for you to sign dismissing the case. Me dismissing the case because they're in default, they're not here, and you need to sign this order for me. Right.
Okay.
The judges, the attorneys always make the orders up for the judges, by the way, Crystal. This is something not, this isn't new. This is what they do.
Right, but if they say that they don't have jurisdiction, they refuse to sign it, I know I've heard about what Gerard had brought up before, but I don't know that that has any validity, whereas you can make the claim or the order yourself. Maybe you can. And I've heard a lot of people talk about this, but I just don't see anything anywhere that helps.
No,
me. Other than, let's go through Bill Thornton's order
for the judge to sign to discharge the case.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, if she says she has no, she has no jurisdiction over it. I see what you're saying, John. That then she doesn't have the authority. But I think what Crystal should do is sign it.
If they,
put in there that I don't know what your position is in the court at that time. But you do it yourself. You sign it and you give it to the judge. The judge is just a paper.
Well,
look at
Wait a minute. Can't I just give it to the chief judge?
You can give it to the clerk. How about that?
Yeah. Well, look at it. If she says that, if the judge says that they don't have jurisdiction, is that what they said? Jurisdiction.
Yes.
That the judge told me today she has no jurisdiction.
This is null and void. It doesn't exist anymore, you know. But it becomes a problem because, look, then you don't go back to the court and they continue to move your papers and you lose your house. You got to watch these guys. So the only thing I can see is really to get into that federal court and to move it up the line there if necessary to get your day in court. And look, at the only thing before the federal court is the fact that they are moving against you without giving you your due process. And your wherefore clause on that ultimately is for them to cease and desist. That's it, period. Leave me alone.
Okay.
Leave my home alone. And then you need to maybe even go after people who have tried to change the name of your property, defrauding. That's fraud right there. And you go after all of them for that now. You know, the judges, the lawyers, everyone.
Crystal made a good point. She said there's a chief judge in there. These judges that they're bringing in, they're administrators. They're not judges. They don't have authority. They only have authority if you agree to let them run the case. So what you do is
Yeah, but
is
even
you
the
make...
chief judge doesn't even have authority. What court is... Well,
right.
Maybe it does. What court is this? This is the state court,
this is the superior,
right?
But all of them have chief judges. I would say
here's an order for the chief... Since you don't have jurisdiction, I've made an order up for the chief judge to sign, dismissing the case. And they're defaulted. They're not here, and I'm ready to move forward. And they're frauding me. And he needs to sign this, dismissing the case, and send it to the chief judge and see what he does.
Well, you take it to this with the chief judge, maybe that way, but also put an affidavit in there of the goings on there, and what they said, and it makes sure you swear to
they're a part of it,
and bring that to the chief judge, along with the paper for them to sign the order. See where it goes. Maybe you'll find.
If that judge has no jurisdiction, she can't even hold Crystal in contempt, can she?
Well, I guess not. But,
right.
All right. Well, look. Let's move on.
Okay.
We'll talk some more about this next week, and we'll see where we can go with it then. Are you ready to take the control of the board here?
Brent's going to come on.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to turn to Brent. Brent, are you still with us?
Good night.
Okay. All right, we're going to move over to good night, Crystal. All right, we're going to move over to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law. And his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you, John. This is Brent. Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com. And my comments are my own, not necessarily the opinion of National Liberty Alliance or any of the leadership of National Liberty Alliance. We're going through the Constitution of the United States. And we'd gone through the Declaration of 76, and last time we got up to or through or part of the way through Section 2, Clause 3 of Article 1 of a United States Constitution says this: representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this Union, according to the respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, and 3/5 of all other persons. all of this verbiage here about free persons and bound to service for a term of years, Indians not taxed, and three-fifths of all the other persons is no concern to us now. But what is of concern to us now is the idea here talks about taxes being apportioned among the several states. Says that. Says direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states. Now, that doesn't mean that indirect taxes shall be apportioned among the several states, only direct taxes. It is utterly impossible to have a clue what's going on with the taxing powers of the United States unless one distinguishes direct taxes from indirect taxes. We did a little bit of that last time. But it's so important. It bears stress, and I want to mention it again. Maybe I'll say something different that may illustrate it even better, and maybe not. But if I do, that's good, and maybe it will be more graspable. Direct taxes are taxes that the tax person cannot shift to another. For instance, gasoline taxes are indirect taxes. Why? Well, the man that sells you the gasoline shifts the tax burden that the government puts on him. He shifts it over to you. You pay the tax. Every kind of a sales tax of any kind is an indirect tax because the fellow that makes the sale, he doesn't pay the tax. You do. The buyer pays the tax. The liability is his. The government comes to him to get the payment, but he shifts it to you, so that's called an indirect tax. The government likes that because they only have to go to a certain number of people, not everybody, to get the taxes. In those cases, for example, sales tax on gasoline, the fellow that collects the tax is the tax collector. And amazingly, he doesn't get paid for being a tax collector. The law says he's got to do it for the privilege of making the sale, I suppose. But that's an indirect tax. Liquor tax, tax on liquor, tax on tobacco. Those are all indirect taxes because the cigarette salesman, he doesn't pay the tax. The buyer of the cigarettes pays the tax. He just adds it, see, on top of the sales price. That's indirect. What is a direct tax by distinction? A direct tax is a tax that the taxpayer can't shift to another person. There's no way to do it. If somebody comes to you and says, or if the government comes to all of us and says, everybody in the United States will pay $1 per year. We plan on raising $325 million this way every year. Every person, man, woman, child, baby, it doesn't make any difference. If you're breathing, you got to pay the tax, $1. Well, that's against the law. Our Constitution says such a head tax is against the law. That's a direct tax, though. Direct tax is a tax you can't shift to somebody else. What if the government comes to you and says, we're going to tax the air you breathe? And depending upon the size of your body, we're going to measure your weight, and everyone will pay for breathing air. Well, that's a direct tax. You can't shift that to somebody else, like the gasoline salesman or the liquor salesman or the cigarette salesman. What if the government comes to you and says, we're going to tax every person's efforts to make a living? So every person who makes a living, we're going to tax part of his living. That's called the income tax. Is that a direct tax? Well, the courts have always said, up until in more recent times, the courts have said that that's a direct tax. Income tax is a direct tax. Now, what if they come to you and say, we're going to tax everybody's bank account? If you got $100,000 in your bank account, we're going to tax everybody. The federal government says every year we're going to tax you on the the greatest amount of money in your bank account. If at any point during the year your bank account reached $100,000, we're going to tax you for $100,000. If it reached $5,000, we're going to tax you for $5,000. We're going to tax you 1% of whatever the greatest amount of money was in your bank account for that year. Even if you've only opened the account for 10 days, we're going to tax you on the greatest amount of money you had during that calendar year. Is that a direct tax? Well, ask yourself, can you shift the liability to somebody else? No. Well, then it's a direct tax. Now, the Congress of the United States, we're talking about the general government sitting in Washington, D.C. Their power to tax has always been broad and plenary. Since the Constitution was put in place, our Constitution of the United States has given to the federal government an incredible, almost unlimited power of taxation. They can tax anything they want, direct taxes or by indirect taxes. But this clause right here, Section 203, puts a proviso in there, and it says if the tax is direct, it must be apportioned among the several states according to population, according to the respective numbers it says here. So if a state has 10 million people and another state has 5 million people, only half as many as the 10 million person state, then if there's a direct tax, this says that Congress must apportion that tax among the states according to population. So the state that has 10 million people only has to produce, or the state that has 5 million people only has to produce half as much as the state that has 10 million people, if it's a direct tax, a tax that men can't shift to somebody else. That's what this is saying. And that has been thrown to the wind. It's not paid attention to at all when it comes to the income tax. I see that as a problem. But I add as a hanger onto my statement that that's not the way things are, and these folks have guns and clubs and whips and pistols and cages they throw men in if they don't do what they tell them, the taxing powers. So if you try to make these arguments that I'm making, don't expect them to work in court, is what I'm telling you. Although I read the tax law and I read the cases and I've come to this conclusion. I'm not the only one. A lot of other people have come to this conclusion also. But there are some people that will tell you, you need to push for this, and they don't tell you, you might get thrown in jail if you do it. there are other people that will tell you, this may be the law, but that's not what's going on in the courts and in government, and if you don't want to risk going to jail, don't push that argument too far. Don't rest on it. But it is important that we are honest as we can be individually about what our Constitution says and what the law truly is. And we need to be saying it as much as we can. And we need to be fighting it in court as much as we can think, or as much as God gives us light and gives us gumption and breath to do it. And we're all called to different things, to do different things. Some people are called to be martyrs. Some people aren't. If you aren't called to be a martyr, don't go trying to be one. That'll be hard on everybody around you. Some people are called to do many different things. We're all called to do different things. There are some people that are called to make these arguments. I know lawyers that have made them back 20, 30 years ago and beyond, and they made them and were rejected. These same arguments now, if you make them, you'll be fined $10,000 and thrown in jail for contempt if you don't pay the fine. That's what some courts are doing, and I know some lawyers that have been jailed for making these arguments because they're now said to be frivolous. The courts have said they're frivolous for a long time, so don't make them anymore. We're tired of hearing them. And your conviction or the truth doesn't seem to make much difference. What I'm reporting to you is some of the state of things as I understand it and as I've seen it happen in the courts. Amendment 14 modifies this Section 2 and the foregoing clause concerning representatives in Congress. Remember, representation of Congress is foremost, above all things, for one reason: fair taxation. Not just taxation with representation, but taxation according to fairness. That's why it says here that taxes must be apportioned among the several states of the Union, which are now 50. At that time, it just says several states, which may be included within this Union. Well, we've got 50 states in this Union. And according to their population, any direct tax must be apportioned percentage-wise according to the population of the state, the percentage of that state, to the whole population of the United States. This is a matter of a whole lot of arithmetic by this point, you see, and that's why it befuggles people. I know there are plenty of people listening that can take a pencil and book the numbers like mad. And if you don't want to do that, you can use a calculator. There are people willing to do that. But as a political question, people aren't willing to go this far. And if you're talking about politics and what the arguments people are willing to listen to, making calculations such as how much should one tax, liability for taxation to one state be over another one, people aren't willing to go that far. That's too much work. But nonetheless, it's the law, and the courts are required. The law requires courts to make such determinations in questions instances of question. Well, the number of representatives allowed to each state shall be based upon its population. Number two, Congress must tally the people of the United States every 10 years. That means take a census. And number three, each state must have at least one representative, even if it doesn't have 30,000 people. Direct taxes, to sum up this a little more, are taxes one cannot avoid by shifting them to another without forfeiting one's rights, such as a head tax on every living person or a tax on compensation for one's labor or services rendered. Those are direct taxes, because you can't shift them. This clause requires Congress to distribute any such direct tax amongst the states in proportion to each state's population. Section 2, Clause 4, the actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall by law direct. The number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration shall be made. And then it catalogs the 13 original states, how many people each one shall have. Now, this is called, popularly, the Census Clause of our Constitution. And it empowers the general government in Washington, D.C. to number the persons living in each state beginning in the year 1790. That was 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress, of the Constitutional Congress, the Congress under the Constitution. And after 1790, every 10th year thereafter, an enumeration must be made. And it says also that this enumeration, the census, must never be estimated, but only actual, uses that word, actual. Estimation of population of the United States was a big part of the census the last couple of times it was taken. And the policy of the Census Bureau was to estimate how many people lived here, there, yonder, because they said it was impossible to get everybody to say. But that's not allowed. Our Constitution bars an estimation population and uses the word actual. This clause grants no right to more information than the number of persons. Let me repeat that. Nowhere in our Constitution, much less this clause, is any jurisdiction given to the government in Washington, D.C. to more information when it takes the census, more information than other than number of persons. Now, the first census was taken by United States Marshals in 1790. And then Congress, 112 years later, enacted a bureaucracy called the Census Bureau. And the framers of our Constitution knew that a representative representation of more than 30,000 persons is meaningless. And thus, as our population grows, the number of congressmen is to increase, of course, was the idea. However, in the year 1929, Congress restricted the House of Representatives to 435 members, and it's remained restricted ever since. That's questionable as a matter of constitutional authority to do that. Well, the purpose of tallying the population in each state every 10 years is twofold. Number one, to determine the number of representatives each state will send to Congress. And number two, to enable the burden of any direct taxes to be laid on each state in proportion to its population. And the framers meant to avoid today's domineering and meddlesome federal bureaucrats from the Census Bureau. They are now meddlesome, domineering, and dangerous. In short, the framers pictured a simple head count of people living in each state so that each state's representation in Congress would be fair for purposes of taxation, period. Asking you, the census worker asking you how many bathrooms you have in your house, how many firearms you have in your house, how much medication you have in your house, how many, well, it goes on and on. That's not constitutional. The federal government, the general government, has no powers unless the Constitution grants the power. And if we're foolish enough to submit to all of that beyond what the Constitution says, we deserve what we get. The Constitution says that there's supposed to be an enumeration. Think about that word, enumeration. What does that mean? That means to count heads. Count noses. That's what it means. Bottom line, our Constitution never empowers government to collect more information than the number of persons in each household. Thus, census forms demanding information beyond an actual enumeration run afoul of our Constitution. Section 2, Clause 5. When vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies. What is a writ? Well, that's an old word that means a writing. That's all it is. It's a writ. Reminds me of that famous line of John Wayne. He was a U.S. Marshal in the movie, and he was serving papers on people, writs. And he calls them writs, writ for a rat. So that's what he thought these fellows were that he was serving the writs on. But a writ is nothing but a writing. But more than that, it is a writing from a person of greater authority to a person of lesser authority, commanding the person of lesser authority to do something. So here, when vacancies happen in the representation from any state, the executive authority thereof, that means of that state, in our states we call them governors. The governor is the chief executive authority of each of the states of our union. Doesn't use that word here because didn't know whatever state would call their executive authority. They may call him a president, they may have called him a governor, they may have called him an executive. Chief executive, but as it happened, as the country progressed and states were added to our union, the states decided in total just to call them governors. So the governor, when there's a vacancy, he has great authority compared to others, compared to the ones under him. He issues a writ called a writ of election. That means a command to hold an election. That's what that means. And so he commands that an election be held to fill such vacancies. A writ is a written command from one part of government having a certain authority to another part under that authority to do a certain thing. Thus, if a House of Representatives seat becomes vacant, This clause requires the governor of the state having that vacant seat to issue an order to the election commission of his state to hold a special election to fill that vacancy. If, however, the next regular scheduled election is to be held soon, the governor need not call such a special election. This has come up, and the courts have interpreted it that way. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker, this is Section 2, Clause 6, choose their speaker and other officers, and shall have the sole power of impeachment. Now, this Section 2, Clause 6, under Article 1 of our Constitution of the United States, requires the House of Representatives to choose and seat a Speaker of the House. Its method of doing so is the House's choice. It doesn't say how to do it. It just says you got to do it. And the House gets to choose how they do it. Nobody can tell them. There is no power that trumps the power, the legislative power of the United States. Did you know that? By the way, there is no power that trumps the executive authority of the United States. That's the office of the president. And there is no power that trumps the power of the Supreme Court or the authority of the Supreme Court of the United States. Neither one of these branches of government is above the other. Each one of these branches of government, the Supreme Court, the president of the office of president of the United States, and the Congress of the United States, each one of these are creatures equally of the Constitution of the United States. None of these three answer to the other as a general matter. They are co-equal. That's fundamental. No, the Supreme Court does not have the final word on anything. That's the popular opinion. The Supreme Court has even said that. No place in the Constitution of the United States is such an idea even hinted at. But the same is true of the other two branches of government, too. And that's the beauty of our common law government. That's what common law government is. Common law government doesn't allow. It's been this way for centuries, even going back to the old country and back to the continent of Europe. It doesn't allow any of these three powers of government to trump the other. They are co-equal. Wow. If Americans would come back to grasping that idea, but right now we're not. We're not even taught that. I've asked men in positions of high power that question. They've answered it wrongly. When I say positions of high power, I'm talking about men that are chief justices of the state Supreme Courts. I've asked some of them. I've asked a lot of people. I like to ask questions. I don't argue with them. I just ask the question. I want to see what they're going to say. Well, they'll tell me they're happy to tell me what they know or what they think they know. But as Josh Billings says, it ain't what a fellow don't know that hurts him. It's what he knows for sure that just ain't so. That's what hurts him. Let's make sure that we're right before we go ahead. Now, this clause requires, I said, the seat. It says that it gives them it doesn't give it to them. Really, our Constitution of the United States, I suppose it can be said that it gives jurisdiction to this branch and that branch of government, the legislative branch has the power of legislation, but all of these things are matters of our common law of government. And a Constitution of the United States didn't fundamentally change anything in America. Everything continued pretty much as it was. It clarified some things, sure. But all of our government in the United States is common law government, and it's been likened to the government from the English-speaking country and the English-speaking world. All of it operates according to this common law. It is the way, the process, the relationships, how the branches of government conduct themselves. That's what our Constitution is about. It's not about thou shalt not steal or thou shalt not murder. Even it says thou shalt not commit treason. Yeah, of course, it doesn't say that. It says when treason arises, here's how you handle it. See, there's a difference between that and saying what's unlawful and what isn't. Our Constitution in the United States is a It is a declaration of process, an agreement upon how, H-O-W, things are to be done, not what necessarily is to be done. Let me go here to Section 3, Clause 1. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have 1 vote. The point here is, of course, that senators, this is the balance that they came to, will have 2 houses. That was easy to come to because it's fashioned after the Parliament and the House of Lords in England. In England, they call it the upper and lower house, or the 2 branches of the legislative branch of government. The House of Lords is peerage. That's hereditary. It also consists of the hereditary peers, the sirs, the lords, as they say, and then also a certain number of bishops from the Church of England. That's not hereditary, but that's the House of Lords. And it's still that way, by the way. And then there is, of course, the Parliament, which is elected popularly, like our House of Representatives. So our Congress of the United States is fashioned after that legislative body in England, with the difference we don't have nobles and lordship and hereditary titles. And by the way, when the Constitution talks about hereditary, when it talks about titles of nobility by definition are hereditary. That's an important part. Matter of fact, it's indispensable to titles of nobility. And the titles of nobility of which they speak are understood according to the law of England. That's the law they were just under, and they just took the common law and passed it over. If a title given to a man is not hereditary, it's fundamentally not a title of nobility. Now apply that to the questions you've had about titles of nobility. Now, titles of nobility go down to the oldest son. Are the things that are said in America that are said to be titles of nobility, are they hereditary? I dare say in most cases they aren't. Most of the accusations of titles of nobility in America don't talk about things that are hereditary. Let's see, Senator of the United States, one more clause here. The Senate of the United States, well, I hadn't read that. The foregoing clause about senators of the United States requires that each state legislature pick its state's 2 senators for Congress. Each state legislature, that's where our Constitution is written, had to pick the state's 2 representatives for a Senate in the United States Congress. Now, they were not popularly elected until after the year 1900. I believe it was the year 1912 that changed by amendment to our Constitution. Fundamentally destroyed a lot of the scheme and the understanding of our Constitution. So it weakened the people's stake. People used to elect their state representatives based upon who they thought their state representative would vote for Senator of the United States. The beauty of that, one of the beauties of it, was this. It made people pay closer attention to the election of their state representative. And it tied the whole idea of the state legislature and who you're going to vote for to your United States senator. Our system, we call it our tradition of government, federal and state, indeed the states are sovereign. The several states, as we say, the federal, the general government in Washington, D.C. is in its own sovereignty under the sun among men, limited sovereignty. But at the same time, our whole tradition of government is one tradition, federal and state, and it all works together in a certain way. And our Constitution, more fundamentally than any other principle, is a description of how the sovereign states individually operate within and with the federal government, the general government in Washington, D.C. It's a document that talks about how more than anything else. And due process. How means due process. Not substantive law, but due process. That's enough out of our Constitution for now, but I want to mention another thing before I get off, because the question was asked a while ago about appealing a case in federal court before, or appealing a matter in pre-trial litigation. That's what it was about, before the case had been decided. And generally, the general rule is you can't do that. In other words, you got to let the court run its course, and then if you got something you want to appeal, you do it. But there is an exception. And the exception is delineated by the federal courts, have delineated it in the United States Supreme Court under 28 U.S.C. 1291. Well, 28 U.S.C. 1291 doesn't say anything about appealing before the case is over. By the way, the buzzword, when you look this up on the Internet, I didn't mention it a while ago. I should have. The buzzword is called interlocutory appeal. That's an appeal that you take before the case has been fully decided, before the verdict, before the decision of the court, before the decision of the jury, before the finality of the case is over. If you want to appeal, that's called an interlocutory appeal. Interlocutory is an old Latin word that means interruption. You're interrupting the litigation. You're interrupting the case to appeal. Well, 28 U.S.C. 1292 doesn't say anything about such things. It's just a bland little paragraph. It talks about interlocutory appeals, but it doesn't really say when you can do it. And so the courts have followed the common law first principles in saying when you can take an appeal before the case is over. And essentially what they've said is this. They've said that you can only appeal a case before it's over under one circumstance. And that circumstance has three requirements. And the three requirements are this. The outcome of the case would be, the outcome of the case would be conclusively determined by whatever you're appealing. Number two, the matter appealed has to be something other than the merits of the case. Well, if it's the merits of the case, you may as well go ahead and try the case, you see. But if it's some structural issue, some issue, question of process that would determine the case, for example, our common law requires personal service of one party to the challenged party. It has to be personal, in person, right in front of him. You got to hand it to him. And if there hasn't been personal service, and you're saying there hasn't been personal service, you guys are proceeding with this trial, and I've never been personally served, well then, you can appeal that right then, because that's a jurisdictional question. If you haven't been served papers personally, then the court has no jurisdiction over the matter, and you can appeal that. But you have to show that that would end the case, and if you haven't been served, by the way, that would determine the case. There's no jurisdiction. It's not about the merits. It's about due process. You haven't been served. And if you go clear through a trial without having been served, that's a waste of money. You're paying lawyers, that's a waste of time. So the damage to you is permanent. It's irreversible if they don't hear your appeal. That's one way that I've seen it done. I haven't seen it done any other way, by the way. I've never seen a case successfully appealed that wasn't decided on the merits unless it was came down to, I haven't had personal service or process. I appealed one that way once. It was in another state, and that other state had gotten a default judgment and tried to enroll the judgment against my client, where I was, which our Constitution allows, and because it says that the official proceedings of sister states shall, other states shall recognize those official proceedings. And, a verdict in the court is an official proceeding. So they had the the verdict in one case by default judgment and brought it to our state and tried to enroll it in the court there so the court would enforce it against my man. It was about $300 worth of money. And I said, but judge, and back in that other state, happened to be the state of Washington, back in that other state, they're challenging the whole thing on the fact that the defendant was never served. My client was never served back in that state. And the judge laughed at me. He said, yeah, I'm sure that'll go somewhere. I said, judge, all I'm asking you to do, I'm not asking you to rule the other way. I'm just asking you to withhold your judgment until that case out there is over. He wouldn't do it. So he proceeded against my client. And that was his fault. We decided wrongly. And that case then went on out there. It was taken up on appeal. It went to the appellate court. And lo and behold, the appellate court said, that's right. They reversed the default judgment. They said, these people have never been served process. And they sent me the decision, and I took it to the judge, and the judge laughed it off. And of course, that took his jurisdiction away, you see. But that's how our Constitution operates, the principles of it operate within the courts of the sovereign separate states of the Union. So we're all under the same Constitution to various degrees at various times, but not always. But it all can come into play. That's interlocutory appeal. The key word is interlocutory appeal, and you can find more written on it on the internet than you can shake a stick at. Well, back to you, Gerard or John. Thank you again for allowing me to say a few words. I appreciate it. And enjoy it.
Thank you, Brent. That was good. Okay, I'm going to open the floor up. We got a couple of people, and we have some time. I see Michael still in there. I'm going to go ahead and open you up. I don't know if you had anything else to say, but we left you in there.
Yes, yeah. Gerard, thank you very much. Hey, on that Crystal's appeal, or not appeal, but her process there, with if she would have put that paper in for an order to dismiss the case and that judge claimed he didn't have jurisdiction, what force and effect would that have? Would she have to go then to the chief judge?
Well, that's what we kind of discussed. Yeah, that's what we kind of discussed. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, who has jurisdiction? I mean, they're pulling her in there in an administrative type of a deal. Does he even have, jurisdiction?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, although, you know, they're bringing in these retired judges who are like administrators. They're not really, you know, judges per se, but if both parties agree to it, then it's binding. It's just like doing an arbitration, right?
Right.
But if she's saying she doesn't have jurisdiction, there's a problem. Obviously, both sides haven't agreed to her or what. I don't know why she didn't think she had jurisdiction. Or, you know, Crystal probably educated her to the fact that she didn't have jurisdiction, right?
Right, right.
So it, does the chief judge, I mean, look, at they have, they're sending orders out. They're telling her to show up in court. If she doesn't, they'll arrest her. So that chief judge has a certain amount of authority there. He's going to send the cops out after her if she doesn't show up. And by virtue of the fact that you show up and the other side doesn't show up in normal circumstances, that's a default. If you go, you don't show up at court and see what happens to you.
Well, if that judge had the jurisdiction to contact a police officer to go pick her up, then he did have jurisdiction in the case.
Exactly. I mean, he's exercising jurisdiction of some sort. And so the judge that was sitting there says, I don't have jurisdiction. I would give it to the chief judge and let him flush it out. You know what I mean? I mean, it's an order. And look, you can get orders signed by the court clerk also. Not everything has to be, you know, when it's a cut and dried thing and it's a process of court, a process and a procedure of court, the clerks have a certain authority to run that through too. Most of the time, they're not going to throw a case out, though. You know what I mean?
No, they won't do that.
They're not going to stick their neck out. But,
right,
you know,
right.
I don't know. Look, it's part of us pushing the process in their face. And so
yes.
I would do it just to do it and let them figure out how they're going to handle it. Right. You know, and a lot of times it's fun to see what they'll do, because sometimes what they do opens the door up for your next movement, you know?
Yep, yep.
Okay, and he might just say, we got to get rid of this pain in the neck and sign it and let her go. I don't know.
Right. Well, we just had a win up here in New York, Buffalo, New York, with a traffic case. And it was a lot of appeal. The appeal, the judge remanded it back down to the lower town court. And then we went back into the town court, and it was on traffic. My friend was arrested even. And they fined him $100 and found him guilty. He appealed it. He won it in the appeal to remand it. And then he brought it up again, and he won this case. And the judge says, I don't want to mess with this thing. I dismissed the case in your favor, blah, blah, blah. So that was a good win over here in Buffalo. And now he's going after damages. Now he's going to sue him for damages to the police officer
yeah.
and get his money back and so forth. But what Crystal was saying, one more thing, she was talking about the money that they took out of Social Security from her husband, and it went into a fund, okay, just mm-hmm. a general fund. That's not a general fund. It goes, I believe, this is what I believe. I believe it goes into Title IV funding, Title E, 4E, and that goes into the foster care. That's where they're getting their money, I believe.
Yeah, they got all kinds of schemes.
Foster care and the CPS for stealing kids, kidnapping them.
Yeah.
And that's where that money has to be going.
All kinds of ways of moving money and stealing money and, you know, and they talk about stolen funds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What's that?
I wish somebody could get inside there and do an audit, a forensic audit on it, and to pull up.
Well,
exactly.
Look at what I've discovered recently is they write all this stuff down. It's public knowledge. If you want to go in and you want to see what they're doing and you know how to do research, you can click on it. It's all there. You know what I mean? They're giving you their methodology, you know, and look at common law, common sense. You can read the thing and you can tell that it's not lawful, that it's not right. You know, the average person knows when something's not right. You know, especially when something's running like a organized crime syndicate. You know,
right?
But
right.
They got a lot of schemes that they've written, like John was talking about. You know, regulations on that really don't apply to us, but they make it sound like it applies to us because they say all people and everyone and everywhere and all they use these big encompassing terms. But meanwhile, if it wasn't in the law, they can't make the regulation broader than the law, than the statute.
Well, they tell you right up front, they say any person, whoever. Okay, person,
right.
If you look up a person on the dictionary on definitions in Title 26, which is not law and it can't be law because they change it every year. It has to be a law, has to be maintained the way it's set up. For 3 years, I believe, is what I was
mm-hmm.
with the understanding. But they change it every year, so it can't be a law. But in that, the person belongs to the corporation. They're an agency of, and it doesn't even apply to the people.
Well,
the person.
Yeah, and if you go to court and you say that, they act like you got three heads. But meanwhile, I know
yes.
that like, as you get up into the higher levels, they understand all that stuff.
Right, right.
You know, the lower levels, they're just going by whatever book they pushed, you know what I mean?
Right,
and,
right.
And they're just, you know, after you've been in that lower level court and you've watched the things and some people, especially if you get somebody like Crystal coming in, you got to know in your heart that you're not doing the right thing.
Exactly.
You know? And I think they send these local judges, they keep sending them back to school. Through their state magistrates association, they give them schooling, and they say, "Oh, if you hear this word, that's a sovereign citizen. You know, if he says this, you say that." They do school them on that, as far as you know, how to handle people that come into the court and try to push common law, and that's where you know you get that Southern Poverty Law Center labeling you as some kind of a terrorist. You know, I've been called a paper terrorist, whatever
right,
that is. You know,
yeah. filing too many papers. Okay, well, I'm sorry for your loss, Gerard. I'm sorry for your loss. And
yeah, I appreciate it.
At the moment, I'm not able to help out, but, you know, I will, you know, donate something here pretty quick. But
even prayers, because it's a trying time, and I can see a golden ring around the cloud, so to speak, because going to change things, and it should change them for the better in the long run. I just got to get through the hump. That's all,
Right. I know the devastation. So, I set my own collision shop, so I know what you mean. What happened? But anyway, okay. I'll open it up for somebody else. Thank you very much for your time and information. Later, brother.
Oh.
Love you, man.
Okay. Have a good night.
Yeah, too. Good night.
Okay, we have Cindy from Illinois. Go ahead. You've been unmuted.
Yeah. Good evening. This is Cody from Southern Illinois. And is Brent still on? Or
I think he's there.
I was kind of curious. I was kind of curious. I've been thinking about the Amendment 17, the Constitution, talking. He touched on some of the senator issues there. I'd read where the forefathers' real intention was is the states would have the power also to recall those senators when the legislature elected them, that they would then have the power to recall them if they weren't doing the right thing. And the way I read that amendment talks about the people, electing the senators, changing that part of the Constitution, but I didn't see where, that the legislature wouldn't still have the power to recall them. Are they going to say that because the people are electing the senators and they're the only ones that can recall, is that implied in the law, or are some of these states still missing the boat on being able to recall these senators?
You answered your own question there, because the fact of the matter is that when somebody's elected, they cannot be fired or recalled. They have to be impeached. They have to practically commit a crime, a felony, in order, because you can't have an elected official with a boss. You know what I mean? The people are his boss, and so it's very hard to get rid of somebody who's elected, as it should be, because politics gets, you're going to step on somebody's toe somewhere along the line, and they want you want your representatives to not always be in fear of their job, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when the legislators put them in, it was more of an appointment. They were appointing them, and when anybody that's appointed can be disappointed, pulled back by the one who appointed him. And so what it did is it took the power away from the states. John said about equal suffrage. So now you don't have control over those guys. And so what happens is they're not tied to the will of the legislator and the people.
Well, what law is that legal theory? Does that apply that once they're elected, you can't recall them? Is that, because you could argue also that that was the intention of the forefathers, that the legislature could
recall them, but you have to go through that process. We talked about having the committeemen running petitions to recall somebody. But you can't just fire them. They have no bosses. You have to go through the due process of serving them with impeachment or having them indicted or whatever. You know what I mean?
Is that in the Constitution, though? As soon as they're an elected official,
I can't recall offhand the part that officials are there's a certain immunity there for them, so to speak. I don't know what part that's in. I was an elected official once, and I understood that there was nobody that could actually fire me other than if I committed a crime or something like that. But where it's written, I don't know. I'd have to research that. I don't remember. Maybe I knew one time, but I didn't.
I thought that'd be another angle. The convention of states. They're trying to get the constitutional convention going, and I just thought, well, maybe that's a little bit of an angle where some of these states maybe don't realize that they could potentially, recall some of these questionable senators, and I'm curious if that's an angle, but
You know,
well, I think if they used the process of the committee man and they carried petitions, you know, I mean, how does even Congress do impeachment? They got to have enough votes, right?
Right, right.
So there's an impeachment petition, and I think the people can petition to have somebody removed for cause. You know, you have to lay it out, and then show that you got enough people, you know, and make the case. I don't think there's anything that says that you can't recall somebody following a certain process.
Well,
I know they do it in other states. What's that?
The House of Representatives is supposed to be the closest branch, you know, to the people, and then the Senate, you know, senators are supposed to be controlled, I guess, by the state legislatures, you know, and they said that when then the people controlled both of them, it took away some of the power from the state, you know, to remove, you know, bad senators. I don't know if that was an angle, you know, something's got to be done. Hopefully the convention of states can get somewhere, but I think, they only got 12 or so states maybe to have passed that resolution? Does anybody know? I think it's 12, 13, whatever it is.
I think that's what they had said. Yeah.
836, you know, it's going to take until they ever get there. They may. You know, there's so many political roadblocks. But, I just kind of want to throw that out there. I'm just curious if there was anybody had any legal take on that, if we get the governors' associations or legislatures to kind of, you know, look at that, especially when you get, who was that goofy guy here in Illinois? I forget his name there when they were having a, you know, committee meeting, or not a committee meeting, but they were having their, you know, their deal on C-SPAN. They're talking to one of the guys from Twitter, and he's asking about, you know, have you guys, I think it was for InfoWars or something, hey, have you guys, we're looking at, you know, censoring him. Well, I'll work on that at lunchtime, you know. It's just right out there in the open. You've got, in the United States of America, you've got an Illinois senator, I believe he's a senator, has a Durkin, I forget, but, you know, right there asking Twitter to censor, you know, in America, it's just unbelievable. And they
so
throw these guys out.
You're wanting to get rid of Dick Durbin, is that the idea?
Well, I mean, not in particular, but it's just, you know, I couldn't believe that they show a clip right there where you got the guy from, I think it was Twitter at the time, and he's like, well, what are you guys, you know, what are you going to do something about, you know, I think it was InfoWars or Alex Jones or somebody else. And he's like, well, I'll work on that after, you know, after lunch. And it's just unbelievable right out there on the open on TV that a senator will be asking to censor a United States citizen that's not calling for, you know, violence.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Are you willing to say what county you're from?
Cumberland County, Illinois, way south, you know, down right on
I-70. You around Greenup or Toledo, one of those places?
Yeah, right in that neck of the woods, yep.
Are you willing to say,
am I willing to what?
Are you willing to say your name?
Cody Hare.
I'm just curious. Well, there never has been a United States Senator recalled in the history of our country or a representative from the House of Congress. And during the Constitutional Convention, the idea of recall was brought up. And it was rejected at the ratifying convention in 1788. And I suppose the idea was they figured if the state legislatures are the ones that elect U.S. senators, then there couldn't be a popular recall, as was mentioned a while ago. He who has the power to appoint and has the power to disappoint. He who has the power to give also has the power to take, but nobody else. Well, if the state legislature puts the senator in office, then the state legislature has the power to take him out. Or the most numerous house of the state legislature, which would be the House of Representatives in most states. But it's never been done.
Yeah.
The Senate of the United States has the power to throw one of their members out. They have absolute power to do that. And if they get to acting up too much or get offensive, they can do that. Have you always lived in Cumberland County?
No, I'm from North Dakota originally. I've been
Where?
Here about six. I'm from North Dakota originally.
Oh, I
and,
see.
Yeah, and I've been here about 6 years.
Oh,
and,
I see.
You know, it's just amazing. You know, you come to a state with just such a
well, it's just such so poorly run. It's unbelievable. The, you know, these state employees retiring in 20 years. Illinois Policy Institute put out a study the other day. They said the average state employee only pays in $74,000 during their lifetime of service, and the average state employee makes $92,000 a year on retirement.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just unbelievable.
And, yeah, no, the state's broke, and it's being destroyed, and Chicago controls the entire state, much as San Diego, San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles control California, as the city of New York controls New York, as Las Vegas now controls Nevada. That's happened in Illinois, and it's the production is down, the state's being destroyed, and the governor there, what's his name, Rauner.
Rauner.
He's kind of trying to do what Trump's doing, I think. I don't know how far I'll get, but that's all I know about impeaching senators. I don't think it's as a practical matter, United States senators are not impeachable. Or no, I'm sorry, not recallable. They can be taken out of office by the Senate itself. But some states, as Colorado, I remember recently, they have recalled some of their elected officials, some of their state representatives.
On the state side, right? One that was some anti-gunner or something.
Yeah, that happened.
Seeing that, but I was just curious if there'd be an angle on some of the, you know, these darn dishonest senators, if, you know, because I thought they said the intention, so you're saying in the original Constitution before the 17th Amendment, you're saying there was no power to recall? I thought I had read that the intention of the founders was to give the states the power to recall. You know,
no, well, as far as I know, didn't I just research and know what I read, I've never run into any instance where any senator has been recalled. And in the ratifying convention, all that was brought up and attempted, and it was they rejected the idea of recalling senators entirely.
Okay. Well, I thought I'd bring that up. I was hoping there was an angle there.
Well,
you know, the interesting thing about D.C. is they say the richest counties in the country surround D.C. And, you know, it's you know, everybody thinks that maybe it's Beverly Hills or whatever. They said the richest counties in the country surround, you know, D.C. And it's just, you know, it's just sad. All the, you know, we're such a rich country with natural resources. It's just embarrassing. Somebody in the 40, you know, I'm 40 some odd years old, and it's just embarrassing that, you know, with the country with the kind of resources and the population, we're not a desert kingdom, you know, a desert country or something. And, you know, they've just ran us into a hole, and it's real unfair for the younger generation. And something's got to give. I just don't know. You know,
I want you to do me a favor. Would you go to commonlawyer.com and go to the contact page and email me? I would like to ask you. I'd like to ask you a question about North Dakota.
Sure.
Just go to commonlawyer.com and you can do it there. Well, I appreciate you calling and raising the question, though, and I'll turn it back to Gerard. You're still there, aren't you, Gerard?
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Okay, Cody, are you done there? Hang you up.
That's all I had.
Okay.
Nope.
We never know where we're going to go here, do we? Okay, it's been good. Thank you. Yeah. I got somebody in there, anonymous. I don't know who it is or what state you're from, but go ahead, and you've been unmuted. Hello, anonymous. I thought maybe it was the anonymous that was going to give us a big revelation on Q or something. I don't know. Maybe we put them to sleep. Well, I have nobody else in the queue, and anonymous don't want to talk. So unless anybody's got something, we're going to end early. It's 11:40 right now. Oh, here we go. We got somebody coming in. We got a live one. Somebody from Florida. Hang on. I don't have my glasses on, but go ahead. I'm going to unmute you.
Gerard, I am Orange from Florida.
Okay. Yep.
Early John talked about the regulations, and I have this from United States versus Mirsky. This is Supreme Court opinion 361 U.S. 3431.
Yeah.
The result is that neither the statutes nor the regulations are complete without the other, and only together they have any force. In effect, therefore, the construction of one necessarily involves the construction of the other. That's end of the...
Okay, so when that was the Supreme Court, what was the date on that?
It's 1960. It's actually appeal from the United States Southern District of New York.
Mm-hmm. So they're saying that one needs brings the other one, but there's four rulings there that says that if it's not in the statute, the regulation can't expand the statute more than what the Congress put it in for.
Yeah, the basic what it says, the statute without the regulation has no force, or the regulation without the statute, which cannot be such a thing.
Also, it's still saying the same thing. In other words, if it's not in the statute, the regulation can't bring it up and pretend like it is in the statute.
Well, in other words, the Congress write the statute, and the head of the department promulgate in much detail the regulation, how to enforce the statutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's the operating.
And then, in another case, it says that if there is the statute and the secretary of the any department did not write the regulation, that is, the statute is null and void. Regulation by itself cannot stand. There has to be statute first, and regulation
right.
only promulgated. That's from this case. Mersky is spelling like M-E-R-S-K-Y.
I'll look that up and try to understand that better. I know from my own personal experience, because I get involved with the motor vehicle law, you know, in New York State, and there was stuff going on, I don't know, 20 years ago or more, and the Gasoline Retailers Association was fighting with the state on their motor vehicle regulations, and the lawyers said, well, we want to go to the law, we want to see the law. And for some reason, the law, they wouldn't release the law, like it wasn't posted. It was like top secret. I said, I never heard anything so ridiculous. They wouldn't, you know, they give you a book that says motor vehicle regulations. But if you want to see the law, they wouldn't provide you with the law that the regulations were promulgated out of. I thought that was very strange that they had this problem with them showing them the law. Oh, we got this law, but you're not allowed to see it. I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you should demand it then, you know, because that's what I read. This is the federal Supreme Court, and then what mm-hmm. you're talking about the state.
Yeah, but the idea has to follow through, right? In other words...
Yeah, there has to be
something. I'm sure that holds for the states, you know, that applies to the states as well. So in other words, if a state's going to make a state law, it has to have regulations behind it on how to enforce the law, right?
Yes. For example, the lower level of the government, which is municipality, they pass the ordinances, and I believe that corporate angle of the municipality writes codes upon that ordinance, but I'd be mistaken. But that's the same logic I apply what we are just talking.
I think you're right, and you know there was talk here with this SAFE Act. They put all this SAFE Act in, but they didn't put in any operating clauses on a lot of it. In other words, they didn't make regulations. They made a statement in the statute, but they didn't write how to enforce that or what the penalty would be for breaking that, let's say. So they're making it up as they go along, and basically, according to this conversation we're having, that would make that law null and void if it doesn't have the operating clause.
I read you from case law that find law, and that is probably about 20 minutes of reading. I only read you probably 5 lines.
Right. Yeah.
All
well,
right,
that's interesting. That's something else to look at, because that's what we're, you know, it's those kind of things that we're going through now, because this is kind of where we're at. You know what I mean? With the, you know, everybody's getting more educated on the things that they do to us, and that's only a good thing for the nation. You know, we start asking questions, and maybe we'll get some answers, you know? Okay, that was interesting. Thank you. Anything else?
No, I yield.
Okay, thanks. I got one more person in here, so I'll move ahead to them. Thank you for your comments there. Okay, we have April, I believe, from North Carolina. Are you there?
Can you hear me now?
I can now.
Okay, I was on mute. I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, if I may. You know about my son who was convicted and he didn't do the crime. Well, ever since that happened, I have met hundreds of people the same thing that happened. And I've met a lot of people also that children are being taken away through CPS. And I also had my own experience with my grandchild through CPS. And I wanted to know, is there a way for us parents, we the people, to put a big lawsuit together and to sue the government for wrongful convictions and for what they're doing, basically stealing our children through jail and CPS? And if so, do we have to have a lawyer, and who would we file it with?
Well, we've run into different people that are part of groups. There was one guy on here that was running a group for fathers, because the courts were really vicious against fathers here. You know, if you were a white male, forget about it. You didn't get custody, you didn't get nothing. They throw you in jail, expected you to pay this child support, and then you couldn't go to work. It's really egregious. So there was a group that started out for fathers, and I think and they were doing pretty good. They were going in the courts, and they were funding. And they had attorneys. I'm pretty sure they hired attorneys also. But I don't know the name of them. I'll have to see if I can figure out who that was. Then eventually they branched off, and they just did everybody, mothers and fathers. Look, the courts are so bad. You know, there's nobody that they won't abuse. Mothers, fathers, children, it doesn't matter. You know, they make you hire this attorney for the child, and I'll tell you what, as far as representation goes, a lot of them are the most. I mean, some of them are really really good, but some of them are just lazy. It's horrible. They don't know who the kid is. They don't do the visits they're supposed to do. They're making judgments, and they never even met the child. This is an attorney that the court gives for the child, which is not – it's a good idea. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you got a real contentious thing going back and forth, I think that child does need representation, because they become a pawn in some of these games. You know what I mean?
Yeah, even if they have representation, my grandson had his own attorney, court-appointed attorney, and I was the closest one to him. They still took my grandchild and gave it to her parents, and she was the one that had CPS taken her children, because her and her husband killed somebody else's baby. And then they give my grandson to the grandfather, who lives a state away, and now I can't even see my grandson.
These are horrible stories, and
yeah,
I'm telling
are.
You, they're
but I hear more heart. I hear, like, my son's story is horrible in itself. I mean, it's going on 6 years now. He's wrongfully convicted, and he's got 73 years over his head for things he didn't even do. And Yeah, and I'm still fighting it. I'm not giving up, but I'm still in contact. Like, I belong to Virginia Accountability Group, because that's where Jesse is in Virginia. And there's a lot of people that want to do something about it, and all I keep thinking is, why can't we put in a major lawsuit with the government? And is there a way to do that, and do we have to have a lawyer to do it? Or can we just make up a lawsuit and throw it in there?
You don't need a lawyer. Look, we're in court. We're not lawyers.
Well, why does everybody say when you go to federal court, you have to have a lawyer?
No, you don't. You can't. What they say is and they pull this on us, they say that you can't represent another person unless you're a lawyer. But what happens is you become co-defendants, and one person can speak under federal law. You're entitled to pick a person to speak for you. Look at if you had 6,000 members and you all enjoined in that lawsuit, what are you going to do? You're all going to stand up and talk in court? That's ridiculous. No, you pick somebody to be the spokesperson for the group.
So we could do a lawsuit.
Absolutely.
Okay, and where would we file it?
It's not a bad idea to get attorneys, especially if you're in federal court, because there's not too many lay people, quote unquote, that know all the procedures and things that are going to hang you up.
Right.
So it would, and a lot of times, if you get a group like that, a lot of these lawyers will give them a special rate or donate their times, you know. Mm-hmm. There was a wonderful group over here, and it was a bunch of paralegals, and they did all the – they gave free services to people that – as a matter of fact, they were people who had disabilities that they had trouble getting their disabilities covered. They did cases for people that were having trouble, you know, getting their disability claims. And I'll tell you what, these paralegals were as good and better than some lawyers out there, because that's all they did. They specialized in that thing, you know what I mean?
Right.
And they were very impressive, you know, and so...
So we can do a major lawsuit like that.
The other thing I was going to say is I personally ran into a case where the lawyer for the child never even met with them, never did a visit, and then wrote up an opinion. I mean, that's...
Oh, that's what they did with my grandson and his siblings. None of the attorneys met the children. brought him to court.
I think he should go with this one or that one, and you don't even know the kid. You wouldn't be able to, if he was standing in front of you, you wouldn't know who he was.
Oh, they broke their own, with my grandson, they broke their own rules. And their rules are, when they put a child in foster care, it goes to the nearest living relative. And my son also had joint custody, and they refused to give me my grandson.
Yeah,
so
they
break their own rules. And you were talking before about you were in court where something about that they didn't tell you where the law was to back that up. They did the same thing when I went to court. They kept bringing all these laws up, and whenever I'd ask a question, where is that? Oh, you tell me what law that is. They would never answer my question. They just did what they wanted.
Because they feel like they don't have to give you that's legal advice, and they're not your lawyer, so they're not going to, you know, but the thing is, you know, the least they could do is, if they're going to quote a law, they should give you the chapter and verse of the law that you can go look up.
Yeah, they don't. They didn't.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep, they didn't. But that's like menial to me. I mean, my main thing is getting my son out. But when I hear all these other people, I mean, I'm in contact with so many people now that are wrongfully convicted, over-convicted, or their children were taken away. Like, there's this one woman, she had her grandchildren. They took her grandchildren away from the mother, but the grandmother had custody. They took the children from the grandmother, and then they adopted them out to somebody.
That's why Donald Trump is, because they're doing child trafficking through these courts, a lot of them.
Yep.
That's
in one
about.
State, I read recently in one state, I forget what state it was, in one state there was like 83 kids were missing out of foster care and they couldn't find the kids.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So, hopefully this is on the way out now, I hope.
I want to do something, and I want to do something with these people. So we've all been talking about things, and I keep thinking about big lawsuit because the majority of these people are like me. We don't have money to hire a lawyer. And we didn't have money to hire a lawyer back then, and that's why our kids got railroaded or taken from us, because we didn't have the money for
it. If you guys all get together, what you should do is you should make up like a business card. And when you're in court or whenever you're around, you give those people, say, look, call me. I want to start a group. Because if not, the way you start is you get two or three or four or five or ten, however many people together. The least you can do, and we know this helps because NLA has used it, is you show up in court to each other's things. You know, they don't do well when they know that there's other people there as witnesses. And people should make an affidavit of what went on in court that day. They'll tell you, affidavits don't mean anything, but they fear them. Because if the affidavit differs from the transcript, from the court transcript, then you know you have a problem. You know what I mean? So if you had two or three court watchers, or five or six or 10 or 20, and their accounts differ from what's entered into the record, you got them. A lot of the judges will notice. When you go to court with other people, the judges notice. And we've seen this time and again. And that was one of the things that helped out in those trials out west with the Bundys, and that is that enough people kept showing up in the courts that they weren't able to do business as usual, and they were so bad that they actually turned the jury against them. You know, they had a stacked jury, and they couldn't even get a conviction with a stacked jury because they got so bad the jury got disgusted with them, as they should have.
People were outraged on it. Yeah.
So I suggest you get with a bunch of people, and what happens is you'll find an attorney, and if you pull your resources, you know, each person doesn't have to pay the attorney can say, raise X many dollars and I'll run this case, you know, in through the courts, and I'll enter you guys in as defendant or plaintiffs or whatever. There's way, when you get a group of people, it's just easier. Fighting alone is not a good idea. It's almost impossible. No. There's safety in numbers. Look at the fish in the sea.
I want to get 3,000 or more people is what I want. Right. And I think I know a lot of people right now. I know it's a couple of hundred people that I know right now. And then there's more and more people coming every single day or coming into the group saying, my child was just taken from me, or my husband was just arrested for something he didn't do. I mean, it's sickening. It's really sickening.
Well, that's where you got to learn how to use the electronic media as it's a double-edged sword. It can be bad, but it can also be good. I know people that got out of trouble because they went on Facebook, and raised a ruckus. There was that soldier that they were gonna railroad, Anyway,
and when it comes to soldiers, you got more backup. I had one more quick question. My son got a couple of tickets actually for speeding. When he went to court, he never got to say anything. He didn't get to say I object. I want a hearing. Nothing. And they fined my son like almost $2,000 for these tickets, and they took his license. Is there a way I could write a motion or write a letter to the judge asking him to reduce this fine because it is causing my son hardship?
Well, you could always do that. There's nothing to stop you from doing that. I don't know if the judge would listen to that. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, usually what they try to do is they try to get you to plea bargain, and you don't get a chance to say very much at that point. Usually the prosecutor and your son should have had a meeting.
Right.
I mean, so in other words, I don't know what they did, as far as they didn't have a trial, but it almost sounds like your son didn't object or whatever. They moved ahead.
He said he couldn't even object. He said he went up to the prosecutor. The prosecutor said something to him, and then the judge decided from there, and he didn't get to say nothing, he said.
Yeah, see, that sounds like they railroaded him. I mean, I don't get that.
Oh, yeah. Because they was on a speed trap, too. So, yeah, it was.
Yeah.
But he's only, he's 26 years old, and this has taken his license and caused him some hardship. And I don't think it's right. It's not fair. So I was thinking of, like, writing a letter to the judge asking, oh, like, what do you put, a motion for amend? A motion
yeah,
to
well,
amend?
This is a local traffic court, right?
Right.
I mean, so they don't, you know, they're not familiar with all those procedures, and they may not even recognize it, but... You know, you have to start somewhere. Yeah, I would send it to the judge. I don't know, make a motion. He's going to say there's no trial to make a motion on. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I mean, you could take
so
his
just write
case
a letter?
Number. You could take right. his case number, and you could try to open the case back up. We've done that.
How do you do that?
You know, you put in the whatever his docket number was.
Right,
and then you put it into the court like you're going to sue them, so you know, and you put them down as defendants.
Right.
But you know, I don't know. You know, look, you're dealing with a traffic court judge. I don't know if he's going to do anything for you if you write a letter. It's certainly worth a try.
Yeah.
But you know, and then you know, the only other thing you can do is to take it up into the higher court and go after them. You know what I mean? As far as you know, them not giving you due process or whatever. You know.
And charging a ridiculous amount of money for,
yeah,
then they take your license and it makes them, I mean, younger generations does not want to drive around without a license.
Exactly.
You know,
they're just making it so
hard on kids.
Yeah, it's never easy. Traffic court's tough. I mean, it's actually easier to pay the fine, but when they do it like that for a young kid, that's, like you said, that's enough to break him.
Yeah,
but
he
look,
couldn't,
I
even,
get
he couldn't make
of,
enough,
I missed
yeah.
the nod
okay.
before. We only got a minute. We're a minute over. I want to just give
okay.
a nod.
Okay. Well, thank
okay.
you. All
yeah.
right. I yield.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Go ahead, Anonymous. I missed you last time. We're kind of over, but state your question. I'll see if I can help you.
Hey, Jared, Jeff Gall here. I just want to comment on this woman that just, in case she's still listening, she only
yeah,
has okay. usually 30. She has usually only 30 days to appeal, and it has to come from the son, and it has to be done, you know, formally, properly. So she's going to write a letter. She should do it very quickly, and if she wants to appeal, she wants to make sure that 30 days.
I'll bet you it's been more than 30 days already. But
yeah, I mean, I wasn't really sure, but hey, I just wanted to see if there's anyone that could possibly team up with me. I in the town of East Greenbush, I did get my committeeman petition, and the Board of Elections for Rensselaer County had a primary, not for committeeman, but for whatever the county appointment is, which is so their petitions were not the same as mine. And actually, in a recorded conversation, the County Board of Election Commissioner told me that he has nothing filed, which is a prerequisite, as far as I know, to allow him to merge both titles into one. And I'd just like to sue them.
What do you mean both titles? What are you talking about? You talking about committeeman versus member of the county committee?
Correct. Yes. So, because my petition was correct.
He's hanging himself. Look, I'm surprised he went there and even said that. Tell him to give you that in writing.
Oh, well,
Tell him you want in writing that he has no authority to merge the two, and he's absolutely right. He doesn't have an authority because one is an elected official and the other one's an appointed official. That's the difference.
Right.
So, actually, what he's saying, it shows more... You know, when we went in and we put down committee man, they just took us. They didn't even realize we didn't say member of the county committee, which is basically a appointed position, not
right.
elected. And that's why
right.
they're not standing in there. If he's telling you he has no authority to merge the two titles, first of all, what did they do with your application when you put in for committee man?
Well, I mean, they filed it.
No,
it was they
for
stamp.
Committee.
What's that?
Is he saying there's no such position as committee man? It has to be.
He said they're the same thing. He said that the appointment for the county is a committee person. It's the same thing. Just which is just nonsense.
I don't think it's the same thing. Okay, so ask him. Can the county chair fire a committee man or not?
He actually said that, it's funny, I asked that question. He said, oh, the county chair cannot get rid of either one of them. Doesn't matter.
Well, he's operating more like a committee man, which they don't do that around here. The county chair is like king, and he fires every, you know, look at those. If you read the party rules, it says that they're putting their names in to be appointed after the first meeting by the chair, where the committee man is deemed elected at the primary. This is an easy lawsuit if you think about it. Just think about it. The terminology we're using, and he's trying to. If at one point he's saying they're the same, but yet they're different. I don't think he knows what he's talking about.
Well, I feel like he was educated before he had the conversation with me. He avoided me. I was contacting every day to find out if there was any other petition filed. He avoided me for the time, I think it's 3 days. All of a sudden he called me and said, yeah, I've been away, which, you know, I mean, he shouldn't have been away, number one. But, I mean, I think there was, you know, this conversation that
you
took place.
You mean he said there was somebody else that filed beside you?
Yeah, well, there's one person filed on behalf of herself and another guy for the county appointment. And actually, their title was as public officer, which was not correct. And I don't know if he was obligated to, you know, to reject it just because it was, you know, that was incorrect. But
yes, they're such sticklers. You put the address wrong or the date or anything, they throw the petition out.
Right.
So, you know, they're making exceptions where they want exceptions.
Right.
But look, if you put a petition in, and somebody else put the petition in for the same position, then you guys should have both been on the ballot, and the people should have had an opportunity to vote for you. And if they didn't do that, he's in trouble, because that's not your job. That's his job. When you said, I asked if anybody else ran, that's his job. That's, you put the thing in there, and if somebody's running against you, they have to tell you you're going on the ballot.
Right.
They never put people on the ballot, by the way. You'll never see a committee man on the ballot. They move heaven and earth to not let that happen. You know what I mean?
Well,
but
I mean,
that's the way it's supposed to be.
Well, another part of this is that there's a woman appointed by the governor, Sugarman, I think her name is. She's supposed to be the lawyer overseeing all this, and I gave her the facts, very clear facts here, and she responded totally alleging to have misinterpreted what I was saying, and she said that my time to object has expired. And so I responded, well, no, it hasn't, because I didn't know, you know, that he was going to try to intermingle both committee men with, you know, being, you know, an appointment by the county. I had nothing to object until he did it. You know, so you can't tell me my time has expired, you know, for something that I didn't know was going to happen. And she's since ignored me 100%. She won't even talk to me anymore. I actually talked to the governor's lawyer. I forget his name, an Italian sounding name, and he said that there's really nothing he can do. It's her, everything's left up to her. So you know, the interesting thing for me is that I'm telling them that, you know, this is a GOP petition. They don't care. You know, she's going to protect either side when it comes to the people taking over our government. So I mean, I need someone to join me in here. I don't care if it's for monetarily, but just to freaking make sure that I do it, you know, intelligently. I mean, do you guys know of anyone that has done this before?
I don't know anybody in particular. There was, when we were doing the committee man thing, there was people that were, you know, doing stuff in the courts.
Right.
You know, and as far as that goes. But, you know, I could talk to John about it, because, look, you could file a case in court. You could sue that particular person for what they did, because they violated your they disenfranchised you.
Right.
They didn't give you your say in your vote. So I don't care the time for whatever. you know, it was fraud, and it's still fraud, and there's really no statute of limitation on fraud like that. You know, like you said, you didn't know he was going to do it till he did it, and of course, the time, you know, I don't know how long ago did this. When was your primary? How long ago was that?
It was like 3 or 4 days ago.
Well, there's not 30 days up then, is there?
No.
Yeah, so I would think that you could get something into the court before 30 days is up, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's my intention.
And they would have to answer it.
Right.
And I would put something in. I would sit down and write some kind of a brief, you know, make the claim, make the affidavit, and file it in the court.
Gerard, do you remember the name of that guy that that was kind of like the guru in New York State on community?
Well, that was Lenny Roberto that we that was doing primary challenge, that knew all of the, and he would be a good guy to talk to, but they scared him. He may not want to talk to you.
Really?
He kind of got spooked towards the end because he was getting a lot of people and he was making a lot of, you know, hay, so to speak, and of course, then we got in there, John and I, and some of us NLA people, and the way we were talking, he really got scared.
Well, you know, I mean, that being said, I got to have a private conversation with him, and whatever it was that he was doing, I think NLA should take that torch, man, because you know we can't be running away from our servants. I mean, what the hell is that?
Well,
you know.
Look, we have every intention to revisit the committee man. The reason we got away from the committee man is because they were doing stuff like that. We took them to court, and we found out that the court was corrupt. So we switched it to what we were doing because we figured, look, at the strong man is the judge. The judge is the gatekeeper there because
right.
he's not exercising the law, and they're pretending stupid like they don't understand you. So that's how NLA was born from New York and national, you know, committee men that came out of
right.
that because we realized that the problems are in the courts.
Right. Okay.
So,
well, listen, I don't want to keep any longer, Gerard. I really appreciate talking to you.
Yeah, we're over now. So.
But yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the call, and have a great night and good job, and peace out, man.
Yep.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye. Hey, Felicia. I didn't want to go without saying goodnight. What's up? If you got something important, we're a little over, but go ahead. Are you there? I know you probably didn't expect me to answer you, but...
No. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Okay. I was researching the Credit River case where, I think it was in the 60s, where the judge deemed that all mortgages was fraud. I'm kind of confused in why it's taken so long for the non-judicial foreclosures to actually go through. And I know Mr. John said something about they couldn't get it into an Article III court.
Right. They won't. In other words, they're giving us a civil court, civil cover sheet, civil court. And you know, right now they want to use Rule 12 and that stuff on us, and they don't want to give us common law. When you go in there, it says civil cover sheet, so then they feel comfortable not giving you the Constitution. So,
okay.
You know, we file it in a common law way, but they're not recognizing it. You know, and that's our battle right now is to get them to recognize the Constitution, the Article III court that we're coming in under the law.
Okay, well, I need to know what I need to do on a personal basis on what I need to do in my own case. And I know I was talking to Mr. Jim. All it's going to take is one case to do it, and I want to be that one.
Right. I know. Well, look, even what we discussed, the things we discussed tonight, we're always unpeeling the dang onion, if you know what I mean, because
right.
this stuff all intertwines. I'm finding out that layer upon layer, they all dovetail into this mucky mess that they've made and laid things on top of things to obfuscate, you know, to confuse the people. But it's really simple, though. If you common law is supposed to be simple. They, you know, and that's what they don't want. I mean, my goodness, you look at some of the language that they talk in. and it's done purposely so you can't figure it out, so that you don't go into the courts and object. You know, they got to make it a special lingo and all that other stuff. But you know, I think you can bring a case, and you know, John feels that, you know, well, not feels that, but the federal court is the place that you go, because it's all about them denying you due process, and that's the court that can give you remedy. In other words, you can't go begging into the court that's abusing you, and they just abuse you more, you know. But we need to discuss that as far as how you write this case, and that's kind of what he's working on now by pulling apart these statutes and these codes that they're using, that actually we can use, but they also use against us, and most of the time they're misapplying them. So that's what's going to win the day right there. And so,
the deeds aren't signed, it's whited out, I was in foreclosure, and they was taking money out of my account. I mean, what else do I need?
yeah, well, I mean, that goes all the way up the line, too, you know what I mean?
Well, they redact
all the documents that they asked the Congress for, and that they asked the ABC agencies to give, and everything's redacted, like, you know, you're not allowed to read it. What's that all about? That's ridiculous. And that filters down to what your problem is. If they're doing it up there, it doesn't get any better as you go down the line, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, how is all these other people being able to sue these banks, and we're in federal court and we can't? I don't understand that. I said, why is it that when I research people that sue the banks for fraud, mortgage companies for fraud, they sue these companies, but, you know, my case is in the federal court, and it's like it's at a standstill.
Well, when you're suing a mortgage company for fraud, that's a criminal case, and that doesn't have to be done. In other words, you would do that in a state court. The reason you're in a federal court is because they violated your due process right, and the only one who can really deal with that is the federal court that can give you relief for that. But if you're gonna actually sue the bank or the corporation that did that, and what I would do is I wouldn't just sue them. I would swear out a criminal complaint. That's the newest thing that we've kind of discovered, that, you know, if they broke the law, then it's a criminal case. And what you do is you got to make the charge and put it in the court. And you know, once you make them aware that a crime has been done, they have an obligation to pursue that, and that's kind of where we're at. You know, that we've said, look, these are crimes, and once we tell you about them, you need to fix them. And so, you know, I'll call Jim and get your email. I got your phone number here. I'm gonna. There's a pretty good case on with this guy that talks about how you do a criminal case on them. The trouble is you get it to a point, and then you can get the case against them, but then it has to go to the sheriff. And the question is the sheriff going to do it? But I'm not going to get into that now. We're late. I'll get a hold of Jim, and I'll send you a computer URL that you can go and listen to this tape. It'll explain it better than I can. I only listened to it once, but I remember a lot of what he was saying, and it made sense about the criminal case and how to push that forward. But again, he's running into the same problem we run into, which is that they don't want to enforce this against certain people, because when you go after those mortgage companies and stuff, what happens is the judges are also at fault. They're in collusion, and that's why we can't get anywhere, because you're beating your head against the wall. They're all making money. They all got their fingers in the pot. And so, you know, until enough of us get together and there's an overswell of people, plus, they're getting routed out now, these people that are abusing the system. There's a big cleanup going on. So it is a good time, I think, for you to push the case. You know, we don't know what's going to happen.
It's been a year. Next month was been a year that I've been homeless. So,
yeah.
And I don't enjoy that.
No, I know. So I'm going to let you go, but I want you to listen to that fellow that talks about how it really is a criminal case, and you should be filing it as a criminal case. And he goes about showing you how to put the paperwork in to do that, you know. And at some point, you know, you're going to get up against that brick wall, but you may get lucky too, because there have been judges and prosecutors are being changed every day.
Mm-hmm.
Every day they're getting replaced. They're retiring. When they say they're retiring and they're doing this, it's because they've been given the word, get the heck out now.
They're running.
That's right. If you don't leave now, we're going to prosecute you. So if you get your case in there and you happen to be in the area where they've put some new judges and prosecutors, your case might actually go. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
So we'll talk about that later. I'm gonna go ahead and close down because we're already 20 minutes over. Okay, Felicia, and
yes,
I'll see if I can get your number. And I know you got to go to the library and stuff, but I'll send you the URL. Just go on there and read it and listen to the video and look at what he says, and then we can bring it up on a Monday night call again. Okay.
Okay, I'm up.
Okay. Have a good night.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay.
Thank you for coming, and we'll be here next week, same time, same station. Thank you, Brent and John and everybody for coming, and I thank everybody that has helped me out, because there's been some good help, and it really made a difference, and I appreciate that. Okay, have a good night, everybody.